both on Global Player and the brand new LBC app. You can read and watch the latest from LBC, put your news categories in the order that you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. It is new, it is official, and it is for free from your app store now. Coming up at one, it's Sheila Fogarty. Next, Lewis Goodall.
He's on honeymoon, Tom. How dare you? Why don't you leave the man alone?
Leave Shirley alone.
Yeah, she's off your Christmas card list. Trump and Zelensky, Starmer, Macron, Merz, the great and the good of Western diplomacy. All hail the major breakthrough at the White House yesterday. European leaders went to bow at the feet of the court of Trump in a desperate attempt to lob the ball back into Vladimir Putin's court. In that, perhaps, they succeeded. There is talk of a bilateral summit, which Trump certainly doesn't want. But what in reality changed yesterday? Isn't the truth we are in an endless holding pattern, each side trying to court Trump's favor, each time Trump believing the last person to whom he was speaking? Do you have any belief, any faith, as the PM chairs a coalition of the willing today, that we're any closer to peace? And crucially, would you support British troops on the ground? 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, President Trump says yesterday's meeting at the White House was a very good step towards peace for Ukraine and Russia. Mr. Trump says he started to arrange a face-to-face meeting between Vladimir Zelensky and Vladimir Putin. The US president also said that America will be involved in guaranteeing Ukraine's security. Government Minister Thorsten Bell says Europe has a key role to play.
We and 30 other countries, now including the United States, need to be prepared to play our part in providing those security guarantees. We can't ask the Ukrainian people to sign up to a system of just trusting President Putin after the illegal invasion 3 years ago. So if we want to see a meaningful peace, it will need to involve meaningful guarantees.
In the last few minutes, it's been confirmed to Keir Starmer will co-chair a call of the Coalition of the Willing later, following yesterday's meet at the White House. Qatari and Egyptian mediators are waiting for a formal response from Israel about a 60-day ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted a US-backed plan in exchange for the partial release of some Israeli hostages. Israel says it wants a comprehensive deal that would see all captives returned. A charity is warning teenagers are still being bombarded with content about suicide and self-harm on social media. The Molly Rose Foundation analysed videos recommended to a 15-year-old girl's account just before the Online Safety Act came into account. It found almost all the videos recommended on Instagram Reels and TikTok were harmful. The foundation's director, Andy Burrows, has told LBC further action is required.
Preventable harm is now happening on this government's watch. We know that we lose a young person to suicide where technology plays a role every single week. And so it is for the politicians to decide, are they prepared to roll up their sleeves and take the decisive action? Yes, to build on the legislation that we've got, but to strengthen it.
The Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, says 45 websites are being investigated under the new act. Instagram's owner Meta and TikTok say they both proactively take down 99% of harmful content. A council's expected to find out later whether it's been successful in its legal attempts to stop a hotel in Essex being used to house asylum seekers. Epping Forest District Council applied to the High Court for a temporary injunction over the use of the Bell Hotel. It says the area has experienced unprecedented levels of protest and disruption. And it's reported the Chancellor is looking at a major reform of stamp duty. Instead, people who own and live in properties worth more than £500,000 could pay an annual tax. The government says it won't comment on speculation. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 17 at £91.74. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunny spells will develop for Wales, the southeast of England and far west of Scotland. Later, some heavy rain for southern England, highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Well, very good morning to you. The time is 10:04. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week on LBC. And what an extraordinary, remarkable, insert your superlative here, evening it was, late afternoon at the White House, with the sight of so many European leaders descending upon Washington, D.C. to protect almost bodyguard-like, phalanx-like Vladimir Zelensky, to try and ensure that there was no repeat of the bust-up, the showdown in the Oval Office that we saw back in February. Was it a success or not? I'll share my thoughts with you on that in a second. What we can say is that there is already further movement this morning. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is going to chair a virtual meeting of the so-called Coalition of the Willing, his phrase, this morning to update leaders on the outcome of what discussions in Washington yesterday. That's the coalition, a group of nations, essentially, including the UK, France, Germany, that have pledged to protect peace, to act as a guarantor of peace in Ukraine when and if it is achieved. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz saying the meeting will discuss those security guarantees which were proffered, hinted at, insinuated by Donald Trump yesterday. More on that in a second. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk will also attend. Meanwhile, the former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev posted his disdain for the group on social media this morning. The anti-Russian warmongering Coalition of the Willing failed to outplay at POTUS on his turf, he wrote on X. And that, I think, embodies exactly where we're at this morning, which is a six-month-long fight battle for Trump's ear, for his perception. That is what everything yesterday was about. When you saw European leader after European leader kiss the ring of Donald Trump, get to bow down in front of him, be obsequious even towards him, it was about inhabiting the universe of Trump. When they said things about how brilliant the trade deal was with the EU, about how much closer he's brought Europe to peace than has been the case for 3.5 years. It is not because they believe any of this stuff, essentially. Most of them will have little time for Trump. It is all about trying to court his heart and soul and trying to convince him as to which side is the true impediment to peace and the path to the Nobel Peace Prize he so desperately craves. That was what Vladimir Putin was doing in Alaska on Friday. That is what Keir Starmer, Friedrich Merz, Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen and others were doing in Washington yesterday. Russia, for its part, has shown what an impediment to peace it is just overnight, despite those talks in the White House on Monday. Ukrainian officials reporting fresh attacks launched by Russia overnight. Overnight, Ukraine's foreign minister, Andrei Sybiha, had posted on X this morning. Overnight, Russia launched 270 drones, as well as ballistic and cruise missiles into Ukraine. There's been damage to the energy infrastructure and injured civilians. This once again demonstrates how critical it is to end the killing, achieve a lasting peace, and ensure robust security guarantees. So where are we after last night? Well, as always with these things, there's a positive and negative side of the ledger. This is my brief assessment as to where we are. Positives. Trump was charmed by Zelensky, by comparison to last time. The suit gambit clearly worked well. Zelensky handled that adroitly and with some aplomb. It wasn't worse than last time. It was much better. That said, that is a low bar. Pretty much the only way it could have been worse than last time if they'd ended up in a fist fight with each other. But clearly, it went much better. The Western leaders played Trump well. They appealed to his vanity. They appealed to his ego, which is pretty much the only thing they could do in this situation. The ball is back in Putin's court to some extent. He has now got to decide whether to have a bilateral meeting with Zelensky, something he has been very reluctant to do because he has described Zelensky as a Nazi and described him as an illegitimate leader, all of these lies and nonsense and mendacity. So that is something he will now be under some pressure to do, although I suspect he will just try and kick it into the long grass. Trump clearly wants a deal. I mean, you used to say, think of Trump as an isolationist. He's not acting like an isolationist now, far from it. He's putting himself at the center of the global order. He wants, for whatever reason, I think some noble reasons, I think he genuinely does want to stop the killing. I think it horrifies him when he sees it on cable news, which he watches a lot of. He clearly is desperate for a Nobel Peace Prize, more prosaically and more selfishly, but nonetheless, he clearly wants something. He's not a disinterested party in this or an uninterested party. He wants something to come out of it, which the European leaders are trying to clearly play with. That's all positive. On the negative side, These security guarantees which have been hinted at, they are highly nebulous. It struck me yesterday, it felt to me yesterday, that what the Europeans were doing their best to do was to talk up whatever meagre security guarantees Trump has hinted at without being completely sure as to what they mean or what Trump will actually do. And they're trying to bounce him slightly, which could backfire. Trump is still clearly enamoured with Putin. He trusts him when he shouldn't. He buys into Putin's origin story of the war, which is a bad thing. The new sanctions, which were hinted at only a week ago, they're gone. They're not on the table anymore, it appears. And he's no longer interested in a ceasefire. Again, a Putin objective. So there were some positives, there were some negatives. And although Keir Starmer is talking about, and Emmanuel Macron, some big breakthrough, to me, what they basically agreed to do yesterday is to keep talking. That means everything's still on the table, but relatively little was achieved. There is still this big question, of course, as to whether there will be boots on the ground, something the Russians have rejected the idea of. I want to talk to you this morning about what you think was achieved at that meeting yesterday, whether you think Trump is a peacemaker, after all, and indeed whether, in theory, you would at least be willing to consider the idea of sending British troops to Ukraine. 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. Let's first turn for his assessments, Lord Peter Ricketts, crossbench peer, but of course, most germanely, former UK National Security Advisor. Lord Ricketts, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What's your assessment of where we are this morning after that extraordinary sort of summit in the White House?
Yeah, well, I basically agree with you, Lewis.
Oh, that's reassuring.
I think you covered a lot of ground there, and I wouldn't disagree with much of it at all. Yes, it is a competition for Trump's ear and Trump's judgment. After all, he is in this extraordinarily powerful position. I mean, more powerful than other American presidents at the moment, since he seems to be able to brush aside any kind of congressional control on what he does, judicial control. He seems to be ruling very much in a highly personalized way, has this immense power of the US more or less at his gift. And so what he decides to do, for example, in continuing to support Ukraine with weapons, albeit having the Europeans buy them, intelligence support to Ukraine, economic support, all those things are critical for the future, not just of Ukraine, but of European security. And the one thing I think I'd add to your comments is that meeting with the European leaders, I agree, was in some ways cringeworthy, in some ways entirely remarkable that they all turned up so quickly. It was a demonstration of European unity behind Ukraine. Mm. And if you go back to a few years ago and you think about how extraordinary it would have been for a Brit to be alongside the French, the Germans, the other Europeans at any kind of meeting like that in the post-Brexit years, now Keir Starmer feels completely natural in the role of a kind of co-leader with Macron of the European coalition of the willing. And I thought they did a pretty good job at putting across their arguments. Yes, bucket loads of flattery, but also getting some key points in about security guarantees. You're absolutely right that it is still very vague what this security guarantee point means. I think we perhaps talk about that in a moment. It's clear that they haven't convinced Trump on a ceasefire. He has this naive assumption that Putin actually wants peace, whereas what Putin wants is a very complicated, endless negotiation over lots of points which are actually in Russia's interest and which amount to inviting Ukraine to surrender. So an awful lot still to do, but it could have been an awful lot worse. I think that's my bottom line.
Just to sort of drill down on this security guarantee stuff, I mean, obviously there's a question of practicality. The Russians have already rejected the idea of troops and have always rejected the idea of troops on anywhere near their frontiers. But I suppose which way is it? Is sort of glass half full or glass half empty thing? Because on one sense, you could say, look, Trump, 6 months ago, 3 months ago, it would have been unbelievable that Trump would even countenance or consider the idea of security guarantees. He just didn't want to know. Now it's very, very vague. And as I say, it felt to me as if the European leaders were alighting upon something that was pretty, pretty willowy. But he did say it. What do you think? He's talking about Americans having some sort of coordinating role. Would that be sufficient? And do you have any real sense of what that might even mean?
Well, I'm even more unsure about it than you are, Lewis, because I'm not sure that the Europeans are clear what they mean either.
No.
I mean, it seems to me there are two very distinct things which you could put under the headline of a security guarantee. One is to guarantee we will continue to support Ukraine for the long term. Weapons, economic support, intelligence support, training, logistics, staff, officers in their headquarters, but not actually boots on the ground. That's, you could say, is a guarantee that we will stand behind you. The other one, which I think most people have in mind when they talk about it, is basically a collective security guarantee, like in NATO, which is basically an attack on one is an attack on all. Therefore, if there was another Russian attack on Ukraine, there would be a commitment by those giving the security guarantee to go to war to support Ukraine. I don't think there's any chance at all that the Americans would agree to that. I'm not even sure that if it's examined closely, British Parliament, British people would be very keen on that either. So I think essentially we're talking about the first, not a NATO-style collective defense guarantee of one for all for one, but more an extended commitment to support. If it's that, then there are different ways the Americans could be part of that. They could be helping out with air surveillance, with sea surveillance, with intelligence, with logistics support in the background, with the Europeans doing more, possibly with people actually on the ground in Ukraine, although not on the front line. I mean, if I'm wrong, if they really are talking about a genuine commitment to go to Ukraine's support if it was attacked again with serious military force, well, I don't think European leaders have been clear about that with their own people either yet. So there's an enormous amount of uncertainty and vagueness, perhaps deliberate at the moment, while people, as you say, try to catch what Trump has said and make it into something more concrete.
Was yesterday, Lord Ricketts, was it to some extent? I'm not just talking about the flattery here, but the fact that they all mobilised so quickly, the fact that they all felt the need to go to Trump in that way. In one sense, it was an expression of European unity, yes, which is to be welcomed. Was it not also an expression of European frailty? The fact that after all this time, after 10 years since Russia first invaded Ukraine, Europe is still in no position to offer any sort of real strategic autonomy, to use Macron's phrase, or real security guarantees on its own with regards to Ukraine. We still have to go and kiss at the feet of an American president, particularly an American president. Let's be honest, most of the people around that table would rather not be there.
Well, I mean, yeah, the reality is that Europe is not prepared to substitute for American military power in ensuring European security. That's why people have been so desperate to keep the Americans engaged in NATO, to make all the commitments necessary to keep Trump positive about NATO. Because if the Americans pull back, not just from supporting Ukraine, but the commitments they have to Europe, of American troops in Europe, American equipment, the Europeans cannot replace that yet. They've started on a long march towards having more defense capability, one day perhaps being able to do without the Americans, but they can't at the moment. So if they want to be in a position to say to Putin, you know, we are going to be strong. There is absolutely no interest for you in coming back for more in Ukraine, even after a ceasefire or peace deal is signed. You need to keep the Americans engaged at least for a time. We're in that awkward period while we've recognized the need to have Europe stronger, but it's going to take, you know, 5-8 years of investment and work to be able to say, we can now stand on our own feet without the Americans. Yes, it's a bit humiliating to say that, but that is the honest truth.
Do you have any idea what the coalition of the willing might do? This is something that the Prime Minister has talked about a lot over the last 4 or 5 months. He's chairing this meeting this morning. What is it? What do we really seriously believe that it would might be able to do and what its role might be? Because, again, the Russians have always and continue to reject the idea of any NATO-aligned forces being anywhere near its frontier. And really, if you think that at least part of the origin story of the war is clearly Russian concern about NATO expansionism to the east, why on earth would they agree to that? That's the last thing they would want to agree to.
Yeah, I doubt that they would agree to that. But, I mean, let's also remember that Putin hasn't played a great game here either, because one of the impacts of the war is to bring Sweden and Finland into NATO. Therefore, Russia has just acquired another 800-mile frontier with NATO along the Finland-Russia border. So he's lost a lot of ground here as well. No, he's not going to agree to that. But nonetheless, I mean, I think what they've done so far is coordinate arms deliveries to step up European manufacturing of arms, to organize the buying of Patriot missiles and other American weapons using European money to keep the arms flow going to Ukraine. Europe now outpaces the Americans enormously in the economic support to Ukraine and is increasingly supplying more of the weapons as well. So they have done things to get Europe organized in that direction. And I'm sure they've talked in their planning meetings about what more they can do to support the Ukraine armed forces, to make Ukraine such a spiny hedgehog that the Russian bear wouldn't go after it again.
And just fine.
But you know, it's really boots on the ground, I think, is the critical issue that people are all dancing around.
Yes. And just finally, Laura, because obviously it's been suggested Trump spoke to Putin yesterday. He suggested this bilat between Zelensky and Putin before a trilateral meeting between the three of them. Do you think that will ever happen? Because Putin has rejected the idea before.
I mean, Putin will hate the idea of sitting down at the table with Zelensky, a guy who runs a country he thinks shouldn't exist, making every attempt to wipe it off the map and to kill Zelensky. He would find that deeply humiliating to have to sit at the table with Zelensky. He won't accept a bilateral with him, giving them co-equal status. He doesn't think Zelensky is anything like an equal. He might have to do it if the alternative is that Trump loses it and starts again threatening imposing sanctions on Russia, taking real measures. But unless there's strong, real arm twisting by Trump to get him to the table, I don't think he'll come at all. And even if he does, it have to be very, very doubtful that it would actually achieve anything.
Lord Peter Ricketts there, crossbench peer, former UK National Security Advisor. I want to hear from you about what you think was achieved at that impromptu quasi summit yesterday and whether you would support the idea of British troops in any way being involved in the security, the future security of Ukraine. 0345-6060-973. 0345-6060-973. Is Donald Trump actually, after all, a great peacemaker of our time? Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien here on LBC. The time is 10:20.
LBC.
LBC is investigating the impact of over-tourism. Sheila Fogarty was joined by the UK General Manager at Intrepid Travel, Joanna Reeve.
Over-tourism is excess negative impact on a destination. It's something that negatively impacts the local community. We want to tackle the problem, not just pick it up and move it somewhere else. Mm. For us, our how is very much around small intimate groups.
Listen back to the full interview, thanks to Intrepid Travel, on the LBC app.
Being an adult sucks. Adults, they have to work all day.
When adults get mail, it's always bills, and bills suck.
Sure, but we've got a driver's license.
Take advantage of Blue Week to enjoy 1.9% APR representative with up to £1,000 deposit contribution on certain models in the new Alpine A290 range at your Alpine store. PCP Mobilised Financial Services. Order between the 8th and the 25th of August. T&Cs apply.
This is your business. This is your business supercharged with the help of Xero Accounting Software. This is managing cash flow. This is managing your cash flow with the help of Xero Accounting Software. These are your customers paying you. These are your customers having more ways to pay you with the help of Xero Accounting Software. This is your business supercharged with the help of Xero, helping you sort your cash flow by giving your customers more ways to pay, so now you can focus on making your business boom. Supercharge your business today with the help of Xero.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345-6060-973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 10:22. This war has gone through various stages, various iterations, those early days of horror, then shock, and in the West at least, excitement that the Ukrainians were fighting back and fighting back than any, better than anybody thought they could. A lot of talk even, what, sort of 18 months, 2 years ago, of a collapse in the Russian lines. And then, since then, a darker period where the Russians slowly, incrementally, have been gaining something of an upper hand, although it can be overwritten. A lot of that period has been stalemate in trenches, sort of trench warfare that we thought perhaps we would never see again on the continent of Europe. Obviously, the question is, if this war were to continue, three-year war, arguably a 13-year war, what might happen if Russia were to win? That is something that Carlo Massala, professor of international politics at the Bundeswehr University Munich, has considered in his book, which I started reading last night, of If Russia Wins. Carlo Massala, professor, thanks so much for joining us this morning. After the Washington sort of summit yesterday, would you say we're closer to your vision, that dark vision that you outlined in your book, being realized?
Well, I'm afraid yes, because I can't see any solution to this conflict with the current Trump administration than that Russia gets what it wants in Ukraine. So, which Russia will perceive as a win, and it will encourage Russia to go even further. Because having the experience that after 3.5 years of this war of attrition, the so-called West is not willing to support Ukraine to such an extent that it has a real chance not to defeat Russia on its own territory, but to change the military and political logic of Russia so that Russia gives in and is ready for unconditional negotiation will encourage the Russians that they had won the war against the West and they can go further if they want to.
What do you think, for those who haven't read your book, can you sketch out what you think a Russian victory, and obviously a Russian victory could mean different things. It could mean a complete military takeover of Ukraine. That feels unlikely by comparison to the early days of the war, but certainly they could achieve something in between, which is, you know, complete domination of the Donbass, perhaps further, maybe destroying the Zelensky government, having a more pro-Kremlin government imposing there. What do you think that would mean for the next 5 years, which is what you outline in your book?
Well, actually, what I mean is basically that Russia will reconstitute its forces. It's already on the way. And that we know from our secret services that there are circles in Russia who don't believe that Article 5 is still something which is very strong among NATO allies, especially with the current Trump administration, which might lead Russia to test the cohesion of the alliance by doing something in a combination with hybrid means and limited military means in one of the, what Churchill used to call, soft underbellies of the alliance, which is a city close to the border to Russia, either in Estonia or in Latvia, where there is a Russian minority. It could be in the Arctic. It could be in Spitsbergen. But it will test, because for Russia, such kind of a test is of limited calculable risk. It will test the cohesion of the alliance, hoping that NATO won't invoke Article 5. And if this happens, basically NATO is done and Russia has won not only the war in Ukraine, but also, you know, the war against the West.
How strong do you think those voices are in the Kremlin?
Well, actually, there are these voices, and our outgoing chief of the External Security Service a couple of weeks ago said that the German Security Service has proof that there are this kind of debates in the Kremlin and that Russia might test the cohesion of Article 5. And he especially said, for instance, with Little Green Man in Estonia, which basically is my scenario.
I.e. a false flag operation, the sort of thing that
Yes, a false flag operation. I mean, you know, like they did in the Donbass. Mm. You organize some kind of upheaval of Russian-speaking minorities somewhere in a small city. Then you send some unidentifiable forces into the city. You occupy the city. And then basically you tell NATO, are you really willing for the liberation of a whatever 20,000-30,000 inhabitant city to risk the full-fledged confrontation, conventional confrontation with a nuclear component with Russia, hoping that a lot of NATO countries will say, no, we won't risk this kind of confrontation then.
What would you say to those who might argue, look, the truth is that what Russia, this war has exposed not Russian strength, but Russian weakness, that they thought they would be able to easily eliminate the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian military. They weren't able to do so. They've been bogged down in the east of Ukraine. They can't even take the full Donbass. A third of it still remains in Ukrainian hands. They've exhausted their manpower. They've had to bring in people from North Korea, from Iran, all of these sorts of places. And their economy has been under siege. They're not going to be in a position, surely, the argument might go, to wage a wider war in Eastern Europe.
But that's exactly the point. Therefore, my scenario is a limited confrontation, a limited provocation. And I compare it at a certain point in this book with the remilitarization of the Rhineland. I don't know whether you know what this is, because in 1936, the Nazis with the Wehrmacht decided to move the Wehrmacht into the Rhineland, which was forbidden
under the Treaty of Versailles.
The Treaty of Versailles, fully knowing that if France or Britain would react to that, they would backtrack immediately. But their experience was
France and Britain didn't.
In the Rhineland, neither France nor Great Britain did anything, so they stayed in the Rhineland and considered this as the unwillingness of the Western allies to do something against Nazi Germany, which led immediately to 1938, to the Munich Treaty. And then we know what happened afterwards. So, yes, Russian forces right now and probably for the next 5 to 6 years would not take the risk of a massive incursion into one of NATO member countries like Poland or the Baltics. But a limited test, I wouldn't exclude.
Are there do we know? And obviously, Kremlinology is a difficult art. But are there alternative voices around Putin who might argue for something different? Who might argue that this, that actually the Ukraine war shows the limits of Russian power, and the last thing that they ought to do is to be expansionist?
I'm not a criminologist either, but what we hear from the press in recent days is that a lot of people around Putin are extremely upset that the war is still going on, in the sense that it costs Russia too much. It costs Russia too much in terms of human life. The economy is suffering. But like in any good dictatorship, they don't dare to speak up because they're afraid of the consequences.
And do you think in Europe we are ready for such a conflagration? Let's imagine that your scenario is correct, and it is a completely credible scenario, that at some point in the next 5 years, perhaps longer, Putin or whoever is Russian president by then decides to test Western resolve. Obviously, Trump wouldn't be in the White House by then, probably. But, you know, there could be another American president of a similar hue and ideological disposition. Do you think that the West militarily would be, can be ready for such a confrontation?
This depends very much if the US is on board or not. If the US is not on board, we will have difficulties. I mean, we have a shortage of manpower in Europe. I mean, I just listened, you know, to Peter Ricketts before. I mean, Great Britain and France are struggling with the idea of sending 20,000 soldiers to Ukraine for a kind of post-war assurance contingency. So we have a shortage of manpower. We have a lack of air defense. We don't have enough deep strike capabilities in for such a scenario. So in all, we are extremely ill prepared to face a kind of Russian aggression against Europe.
Can we be ready in 5 years?
No, because I mean, I think Macron 2 months ago, something like that, said in a press conference, it will take a decade for Europe to have strategic autonomy in the sense that they can replace whatever the US provides right now. I think what we have to do is to narrow this gap as much as possible, but we won't be able to close it in the next 4 to 5 years.
Carla Masala there, Professor of International Politics at the Bundeswehr University, Munich, and author of an excellent, very short book I started last night, If Russia Wins. It is a chilling read, but one that we all ought to take heed of. As I say, want your thoughts on whether Trump is actually the great peacemaker after all, and whether we should be prepared to send British boots on the ground to Ukraine. 0345 6060973. At 10:31, though, let's get the very latest LBC News headlines with Dominic Ellis.
Sir Keir Starmer will chair a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing this morning after yesterday's talks at the White House. The Prime Minister will update leaders on the outcomes of the discussions and also discuss next steps on ending the war in Ukraine. Qatari and Egyptian mediators are waiting for a formal response from Israel about a 60-day ceasefire plan for Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted a US-backed proposal in exchange for the partial release of some Israeli hostages. And the US says the UK has dropped its demand to be able to access the encrypted data of Apple users worldwide. In January, the government issued the tech firm with an order to share the information in the event of a national security threat. LBC weather, sunny spells developing for Wales, the southeast of England and the far west of Scotland. Some heavy rain in southern England later, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Tesco Finest Cod. A different kettle of fish. Pan-fried with garlic, slowly baked in butter, or finished with a squeeze of lemon. It'll get you hooked either way. It's why only the finest cuts of wild-caught cod are selected for our delicate and flaky cod loins. Mm. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, love. Just spoke to Zara from St. James's Place.
Your financial advisor?
Yeah, we've made a plan. Retire early, travel more. Peru first.
Ooh, ¿cómo estás?
Bless you. And Zara's plan means I can help more with your house deposit.
Thanks again.
Planning for the future calls for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
Book a free hearing test today at bootshearingcare.com and save up to £300 with our free technology upgrade. Boots, with you for life. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
A few of your texts on this question of Ukraine. Matthew says, what guarantees will be in place when Putin meets Zelensky to avoid a repeat of the Salisbury poisonings? No, Matthew, you don't understand. The Russians had nothing to do with that. No, we poisoned ourselves. Britain, you might have seen my interview with a former KGB operative on Sunday, Mr. Vasilyev. He basically thinks that Britain decided to let off a chemical agent on its own streets, because that makes a lot of sense. Richard Neil Harrison says, the only European leader with any guts yesterday was the Finnish PM, the only one who made a direct reference to Russian aggression when it was his turn to speak. And Justina says, morning, Lewis. Yesterday's summit is interesting. No one has picked up Vance was the main aggressor in February, with him not being present to whisper in the ear the US president, I refuse to use his name. We've got to use his name. He's not Voldemort. Come on. It's Trump. It's also just funny to say. Cora is in Glasgow. Cora, good morning.
Hi, Lewis.
What have you got? What do you think about this one, Cora?
So, I found the whole thing very frustrating, to be honest. This fantasy game we're all having to play, that Trump can suddenly get a peace deal when he couldn't even get Putin to stop murdering civilians. This is a man who refuses to put any pressure whatsoever on Putin. We have two sides with diametrically opposing views. Neither one has moved. So this idea that we're suddenly going to get peace is for the birds. We've got Putin, who is already occupying three European countries. We've allowed Russia to do this over 30 years, to just occupy three European countries and sit in them. Now we want to allow him to take even more of Ukraine, because we are more afraid of fighting than we are of actual freedom. It makes me really, really upset. I'm a first-generation immigrant to this country, mm-hmm. and I would fight with every fiber of my being. If there was a threat that came to these shores, I would do whatever it is I had to do. And that's what the people of Ukraine have done for their country. Mm-hmm. And instead of really supporting them, we've done everything in a completely half-hearted manner. And now we want to back away because it's too hard.
This is something I said yesterday on the show, Cora, which is that the truth is that the Ukrainians very, very nobly and very, very bravely, very, very courageously have been doing our dirty work for us. Because the truth is that Russia is a threat to all of Europe, and they have been bottled up, thanks to a huge sacrifice of Ukrainian life, of Ukrainian, resources, blood and treasure. They are the ones who've been keeping them at bay for us. And if it had not been for that effort, and if they had fallen quickly, if they had just surrendered, who knows where we'd be now?
That's exactly it. And we also underestimate just how much they are doing themselves to make Russia feel this pain. So all across October, there's been a spate of attacks on oil refineries. These are going incredibly well. Things in Russia are getting chaotic when it comes to people being able to access just gas to fill up their cars. There are regions in Russia right now that don't have any gas at all. That, if that continues, that is going to put serious pressure on Russia. The economy in Russia has slowed down. Every civilian industry is basically in recession, and even the defense industry now is struggling. They're having to put people on part-time shifts because they don't have the orders, they don't have the work. Russia can't keep this up forever. And if we just had the courage that Azerbaijan had without U.S. security guarantees, Azerbaijan, a tiny country right next to Russia, but we in Europe, comfortable Europe, we don't have the courage. I I don't understand. And it's so frustrating. And all that's going to happen is Russia's going to invade again if we keep being weak.
Cora, grateful for your thoughts on that, and much I agree with. I mean, we should bear in mind as well that according to the MOD, we should, figures these are backed up by the Center for Strategic and International Studies in the US. The estimate is that more than 1 million troops have been killed or injured, Russian troops, since the start of the full-scale invasion. A million casualties. A million casualties. That's injured or killed. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Russians killed. All of those graves, all of those weeping mothers next to young boys' graves. That has an effect. Russia is a dictatorship. Putin is powerful. But don't think that doesn't have an effect within Russia, even if they think they're fighting for the right reasons. We'll return to your thoughts on whether Trump is a peacemaker or not shortly. 0345 6060 973. First, though, to events in the Middle East. Hamas has agreed to the latest proposal from regional mediators for a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal with Israel. That's according to a source in the Palestinian armed group. The proposal from Egypt and Qatar is said to be based on a framework put forward by the US envoy Steve Witkoff, who is a very busy man, in June. Let's speak now to Nomi Bar-Yokouf, award-winning peace negotiator, expert in diplomacy, geopolitics, Middle East, and a fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. What do you make of this latest, apparent acceptance from Hamas? Will it take us any further forward, do you think?
At this stage, I think it's unlikely. I don't think that the Israelis will move forward unless US President Donald Trump forces them to. And so far, he has not shown any inclination in doing so.
It's curious, isn't it, that Donald Trump is clearly very, very desirous of the Nobel Peace Prize, but in this particular conflict, he's less interested in it.
Yesterday he actually said that Ukraine was the last conflict on his table, and I was wondering whether that was a Freudian slip and he'd given up on the Israel-Palestine conflict and on Gaza, because he did say that very clearly in his opening remarks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Nomi, can you give us a little bit of a fact check on this? I've heard repeatedly, I was listening to an Israeli government foreign ministry spokesperson last night make the claim that they had been willing to make a deal with Hamas, but Hamas isn't really willing to make a deal with them. What is the actual state of play now in terms of any negotiations, so insofar as they exist between the two sides?
Yeah, so I was also horrified. I heard the same thing. I saw it last night repeatedly, and I thought that that is simply a lie. It is simply not true. It is absolutely not the case. The case has been that Israel has repeatedly rejected proposals because Hamas is insisting on a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and an end of war. And Israel is not willing to accept a full withdrawal and end of war, and they're not willing to accept it this time either. This proposal, it has to be said, is only a 60-day proposal. It's an interim ceasefire with talk of release of only half the living hostages, assuming that 20 are still alive, and we do not know that, because Hamas did not divulge information about the status of the living or dead. That is part of the cards that they play. They tend to only reveal information when it is of their interest, and that is part of sort of the leverage that they hold, knowing full well that it is extremely important for the families of the hostages and for everyone, I think, in Israel to know who is dead and who is alive and what their medical situation is, and this is part of what they're striving for. But again, I stress the main point, unless US President Donald Trump exercises the leverage that he has over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, we're unlikely to see a ceasefire.
Well, do we think that there is any possibility of that? I mean, the briefing seems to be that this, according to a Palestinian official familiar with the talks, that this proposal mirrors the one presented by Steve Witkoff, who is a sort of all-purpose sort of envoy, 2 months ago, which Hamas at that time rejected. So given that that's the case, it does mirror that, do we think that there is a possibility that Trump might up the pressure?
Oh, I don't know. I cannot read Donald Trump's
mind.
I'm not sure he can read his own mind, because it tends to, you know, shift. He pivots by the minute. So it's very difficult to know, and I wouldn't want to. I do not have a crystal ball into his mindset, and I think it's It remains to be seen, but certainly from everything that he has said thus far, especially in the presence of Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and all the European allies that supported him yesterday. Again, he stressed, he said that he's looking at Russia and Ukraine as his last conflict, the last war he has to resolve. And that is, of course, very worrying. So, yes, if he is insistent on the getting the Nobel Peace Prize, then he will have to resolve this, and that may shift. The question is, who is going to persuade him to do that? Will he listen to those? Hopefully, but at this given moment in time, we don't know.
Isn't the truth, I suppose, what we can glean from the current situation at the moment, that the truth is that the Israeli government is not interested at this moment in any ceasefire because they are clearly choosing, perhaps buoyed by the far-right elements of the government there, they are choosing to use this moment of Trump being in the White House and his acquiescence to it, of the fact that they have managed to largely cripple Hamas's military capabilities. They're choosing to use this moment to achieve their maximal objectives, i.e. they're going into Gaza City. They've been quite open that they wish to have a sort of wider takeover of Gaza itself. And indeed, there are ongoing settlements into the West Bank, which the government itself has said, Smotrich has said, is designed to ensure that a Palestinian state cannot exist. So why would they?
They would, again, they would for two reasons. If the pressure in Israel mounts and is likely to reach a point at which it will topple the government, then there is internal pressure. And again, more important than the internal pressure is the external pressure from the United States. Israel is existentially dependent on the US. So if the US decides to exercise the leverage, Israel will have to oblige. So that just has to be, you know, that is just a fact. The problem, the issue is that there are, is a mounting movement in Israel to end the war. Today, the main Tel Aviv, Jerusalem highway was blocked for 15 minutes. A number of people were protesting. Were arrested. These are protests to, for the release of the hostages and an end to the war. So, and Israel is cracking down on the protesters. Some water cannons were used in the last demonstration, and other unsavvy means. So again, the pressure is mounting in Israel. It's mounting potentially in Europe. The question really is what remains on the other side of the Atlantic. It's not only the extreme government. It's not only the extreme element, messianic elements in Netanyahu's governments that are pro invasion of Gaza and frankly also of the West Bank. There's basically been a de facto annexation of the West Bank. It is the fact that Netanyahu himself has devoted his entire career to trying to ensure that there will not be a Palestinian state by his sort of divide and rule policy. So it's also divide and rule between Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank and the like. So this is also his goal. And not, it's not only as described that he's held hostage, which I don't think is the case, to his right-wing government. I think this very much comes, it's very convenient for him that he lets Bezalel Smotrich, as you mentioned, he's the one that gave him the portfolio in addition to finance minister, of being in charge of building and settlements in the West Bank. You know, it was a choice that he made. He also has increased consistently Itamar Ben-Gvir, the Minister of Internal Security and Prisons and the like. So he's everything is done with his with a green light from the Prime Minister, which is actually, you know, they're implementing his agenda. It's very convenient for him.
Nomi Bar-Yakov there, award-winning peace negotiator, also a fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. I mean, this is the point. If Trump really wants that Nobel Peace Prize, there is a very obvious candidate for him to which he could turn his attention, but which he seems entirely uninterested in. He kept boasting yesterday about the six wars that he managed to solve. Not entirely sure where he's plucked that figure from. I can think of a couple that you can credibly say he's been involved with. I mean, the other three or so, I don't know. Maybe it's the Empire and the Rebel Alliance, Mordor and Gondor, the ongoing feud between Dipsy and Poe. Who knows? I don't know. We can't entirely be clear. If anyone knows, do text in on 84850. We'll continue with the conversation. On Ukraine, the time is 10:48.
LBC.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A
safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the 4th time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
Book a free hearing test today at bootshearingcare.com and save up to £300 with our free technology upgrade. Boots, with you for life. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. 2 sugars in mind? Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Arenas full of fans. Stars taking it to another level. The excitement, the glory, the action. And you could be behind it all. Kickstart your career in esports with Global Academy's new esports production sixth form course. Get the skills and knowledge to join a fast-growing media industry. And you could even join Global Academy's own esports team. Thinking what next after GCSEs? Then find out more about the esports production sixth form course at globalacademy.com.
So, close your eyes, picture the scene. Just you and me, alone, enjoying breakfast on our own little island. Sounds perfect, right?
Yeah.
Great, because I've booked Wickes to design our new kitchen.
At Wickes, we have over 70 kitchen styles to choose from, with prices from under £3,000 to over £20,000. And with our spend and save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Terms and minimum spend apply.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:50, but it's 11:50 in wonderful Avignon in France, where Christopher is, who's phoned with his thoughts on Ukraine. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning to you. I must say your programme this morning has been really excellent.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's very kind.
I think one of the most important things that, marvellous, all the heads of government of Europe got together, but they've been too nice to Putin. Putin is a monster. He has got the blood of over 500,000 people on his hands. And it's about time we stood up to him. People say, oh, well, he'll drop a bomb. He will not. He has an estate on the Black Sea the size of Wales. He has a private army of 24,000. He's going to think twice about that. So therefore, my suggestion is let's make sanctions really work. The sanctions at the moment don't work. Mm. And the two areas which will really hurt him. One is cut him out of the Bank of International Settlements. That means he can't do any business. Second, make sure the oil he sends is stopped one way or the other. I'm sorry, I'm being a bit verbose, but I really feel very strongly about this.
No, I completely understand and I agree with you, Christopher. I mean, one thing that I'm sort of surprised about, in a way, for all the talk of Trump potentially levying extra sanctions, to some extent, I'm surprised that there are any extra sanctions to levy. I mean, there ought not to be. I mean, for all of the talk of being punitive and tough on Russia in the during the outbreak of the war, the fact there are still potentially more sanctions to impose, to me, is astonishing. And the fact that, you know, and this has been something much talked about, particularly over the last 12 months, all of these Russian assets which are in European bank accounts, they should have been seized. They should have been seized and given to Ukraine, given how exceptional the circumstances are.
Quite agree with you. Quite agree with you. We've been far too decent to this man. I mean, when this man came down the steps of the aircraft in Alaska with a silly smirk on his face, I mean, there was Trump there, and I might as well have a bunch of flowers to give to him. This man is a monster, and we're not treating him as a monster. And I really feel that sanctions have got to be done in such a way that really work. People say, oh, he'll drop the bomb. He won't. The man is a monster, and he's a coward to boot.
Christopher, in wonderful Avignon, thank you so much. Andrew is an equally wonderful Rill. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How is Rill? One of my favourite places. I'm not even joking. I'm not joking. I used to work in a shop. My nan and granddad had a little shop near Rill, so there you go. Anyway.
Oh, bless. Excellent. Well, it's doing well.
I'm glad to hear.
Anyway, of course. Russia.
Yes. Not so wonderful, Russia.
not-so-wonderful Russia. I'm actually thinking more macro level and even going back to the 1980s. With the situation with Afghanistan, I wonder whether he's still trying to make up for that, because he was a KGB officer during the 80s, and I think that was one of the deepest humiliations they ever suffered. And I think he's looking to reclaim some of that. I mean, yeah. I've known people to do stranger things for less.
Well, we were talking about this on the show yesterday, Andrew. I mean, you know, when we think about the origins of this, people talk about NATO expansionism and all that. It's not that. What this is a deep... You know, Putin may be many things, and most of them, as Christopher's saying there, are almost unspeakable on the radio. I don't think anyone could I don't think anyone could doubt his patriotism to the point of jingoism, right? He is a, he is someone who is motivated by deep historical forces, and he believes that the Russian nation has been slighted, and he is acting out of a sense of deep humiliation after the end of the Cold War. You know, he's the guy who says, you know, we in the West, we say, wow, the way the USSR was dissolved so peacefully, that's a great thing. He's the one going, no, it wasn't a great thing. It was a disgrace. It was a humiliation. We should have been like China and sent the tanks in to Berlin. That's this guy. That's the guy we're dealing with here. And he's trying to address what is, in his mind, a 30-year historical wrong. And that's tough.
Well, I think when you carry a grudge for that long, yeah. I think anything is possible. And so, yes, I mean, you can't take his threats maybe to heart, but you should take him seriously.
Also, they say, and again, you know, Kremlinology is a dark and difficult art, but they say that he also changed a lot during the COVID period. You know, he was so isolated. You remember those pictures of him, you know, only meeting someone down the sort of longest of long banqueting tables, you know, like looking like Howard Hughes or something, you know, completely and utterly isolated. They say he changed during, I mean, lots of people changed during COVID, but most people don't have access to 10,000 nuclear missiles. So not completely ideal. But they say he changed a lot in that time. How do you think Trump's handling him?
Terribly, because I thought the Alaska thing the other day, it felt more like, when I saw him come down the stairs, it felt like the deal was already in. It had already been decided. There's no negotiation. I truly believe we don't think in 50 to 100 year strategic views, whereas Putin does. So he's quite willing to take however long it takes. And we think within, what, the 4 or 5 year political... we think in the 5 year political...
Electoral cycles.
Electoral cycle, exactly. So coming up against that, it felt like there was a distribution of political spheres happened that day. Yeah. Whereas Trump said, we'll have Europe and you can have all of your old satellite states. Let's make some money.
Andrew, grateful to you. Say hello to Real for me. Andy is in Ascot. Andy, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, it's another spin, basically. Trump's trying to do this deal or whatever with Putin, saying about the land grab, land swap, etc. Now, fully commending all the Ukrainians for their bravery, and the amount of lives that have been lost is unbelievable. But can you imagine another spin on it? Okay, say Russia invaded America. Okay, mm-hmm. Now they controlled, say, California, New Mexico, Alaska. Okay. And then the other say peacekeepers came in and said, okay, well, what we'll do, we can if we give Russia Alaska, California, New Mexico, and then the war will stop. What are the Americans going to say to that?
Well, I mean, America. I'm just trying to sort of. I mean, if the truth is, of course, we'd all be dead because it'd be a nuclear exchange.
Yeah, but this is my whole point. It's like, why should the Ukrainians give up their land?
Yeah, well, indeed.
To somebody who's invaded their country, they've fought so hard to keep what they've got.
What they're being asked to accept, Andy, is basically living in another era, right? They're being asked to accept living in an era of 19th century imperialism where, yeah, basically might did equal, right? And, you know, countries, including our own, went around the world and said, we quite like a bit of your country. We'll have a bit of that, please. Well, why should you have that? Well, it's because we've got bigger guns than you. And that was it. Now, we thought we'd move beyond that in the late 20th century and the 21st. But apparently, in Vladimir Putin's mind, the sort of new czar, we haven't.
No, it's absolutely disgusting. And I can't believe that the leaders that are supposedly involved you know, they should grow a backbone and back Zelensky up and say, look, this is not going to happen. Because all Trump wants, Mr. Cheeto himself, all he's going to want, he's interested, or I thought he did a deal with Zelensky on part of the land that he was going to secure it, because they did a deal, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they did it at the Vatican, believe it or not, when the Pope died, to say that he would sign over so many minerals for certain American protection for certain areas.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact part of it. But like I say, if you can imagine America, I've been invaded by Russia. Russia had taken so many parts of land, and then they said, okay, well, we'll do a deal, and you can keep that bit, and that'll be it. But I just don't think it's... They just need to grow a backbone and say, no, it's not going to happen.
And do you trust Keir Starmer to have that backbone, Andy?
No, not at all.
No? Why not?
No.
Why
he's,
not?
He's, because he just bends over backwards. He's just licking the feet of a certain Mr. Cheeto.
Okay, Andy, that's got grateful to you. We're going to move on now. Really interesting thoughts from all of you, but I think we could all probably take a little break from the potential invasion of World War III. We're going to turn to what the government has done on the question of Palestine action and their prescription. This comes after a poll which found that most Labour members oppose Keir Starmer's prescription, its ban, its prohibition on Palestine action. More than 7 in 10 paid-up Labour supporters said Keir Starmer and Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, were wrong to prescribe the group last month. The Home Secretary, for her part, has told us that there is very good reason why she has prescribed the group, but she can't really tell us why. In the 21st century, is that acceptable, and does it not make a complete mockery of the terrorism laws themselves?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, Sir Keir Starmer is to chair a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing after yesterday's talks at the White House. The Prime Minister will update European leaders today and also discuss the next steps in efforts to end the war in Ukraine. President Trump says he's started to arrange a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian leaders. But the UK's former National Security Advisor, Lord Ricketts, has told LBC he doubts that will happen.
Putin will hate the idea of sitting down at the table with Zelensky, a guy who runs a country he thinks shouldn't exist, making every attempt to wipe it off the map and to kill Zelensky. He would find that deeply humiliating to have to sit at the table with Zelensky. He won't accept a bilateral with him, giving them co-equal status. He doesn't think Zelensky is anything like an equal. He might have to do it if the alternative is that Trump loses it and starts again threatening imposing sanctions on Russia.
Qatari and Egyptian mediators are waiting for a formal response from Israel about a 60-day ceasefire plan in Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted the US-backed proposal in exchange for the partial release of some Israeli hostages. It's understood the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is considering a major reform of stamp duty in England and Northern Ireland. Instead, people who own and live in properties worth more than £500,000 could pay an annual tax. The government says it won't comment on speculation, but Freddie Poser, who runs a campaign group Priced Out, says he would welcome a change.
If you can get this right, there are all sorts of positive effects that, beyond affordability, that a property tax can make. It's a direct property tax replacement for stamp duty that raises the same amount of revenue, won't necessarily make homes more affordable. The real advantage here is about encouraging better use of the existing properties we have and making it easier for people to move homes, to move around the country for jobs, that sort of thing.
US officials say the UK has dropped its demand to be able to access the encrypted data of Apple users worldwide. In January, the government issued the tech firm with an order to share the information in the event of a national security threat. The Home Office is yet to comment. And data suggests a quarter of parents in England are going without food or heating in order to afford school uniforms. Many are also buying it with buy now pay later schemes, according to the charity Parentkind. New rules are due to come into force next year, making only 3 branded items compulsory. You can read the school's minister, Catherine McKinnell's exclusive reaction to the data on the LBC app. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 30 at 91.87. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunny spells will develop for large parts of the UK. Some heavy rain, though, for the south-west of England. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Tesco Finest Sugar Bell Tomatoes, the ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:04. We're going to move on now to a question which I think goes to the heart, really, of so many contemporary political stories. Obviously, the ongoing fissures which have been created by the ongoing horrors in Gaza, but also something about the way we treat protests in this country, which both the right and the left increasingly contest and have a big problem with. In particular, you'll have followed what has happened with Palestine Action and their prescription, their prohibition, their banning as a group under the Terrorism Act. This has caused a great deal of controversy and indeed generated, in a way perhaps the government did not anticipate, a great many arrests. Let's just take a step back and just get the facts on this, because this can be a very contentious and very sort of hot issue. So let's just get the facts for those of you who haven't been following it in great detail. This is quite a new thing. In July 2025... the government officially prescribed, i.e. banned, Palestine Action as a terrorist group under the Terrorism Act 2000, citing its involvement in vandalism at RAF Brize Norton and other direct action protests, right? So it was no longer allowed to exist. Since then, 700 people, 700, right? Not 7, not 70, 700 people have been arrested for showing support for the group, with many arrests tied to what were peaceful demonstrations, such as people holding signs saying, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action," capital P, capital A, not just the idea of action to support Palestine, but the group itself. On the 9th of August, so what, 10 days ago, during a protest in Parliament Square, around 500 demonstrators were initially arrested. That was the largest single-day haul in over a decade. That number later rose to 532. This is, of course, at a time when we've got great pressure on police stations and prisons and so on. Arrests have also occurred outside London, and Norwich and other cities. So it's a national thing. Civil liberties groups like Amnesty have raised alarm, and they've warned that the police appear increasingly heavy-handed and that the ban may chill protests and freedom of expression. The Home Secretary, for her part, has defended this action. And this was, she wrote a piece in The Observer, perhaps a telling place to place that particular article at that time. She wrote a piece in The Observer on Sunday explaining why she'd prescribed Palestine Action. She said this: "The clear advice and intelligence given to me earlier this year from the UK's world-leading counter-terrorism system," why do we always have to be world-leading, "was that Palestine Action satisfies the relevant tests in the Terrorism Act 2000. She then added, "For a Home Secretary to ignore all those security assessments, the advice, the recommendations would be irresponsible. Were there to be further serious attacks or injuries, the government would rightly be condemned for not acting sooner." The government's line is that they are not prohibiting or clamping down on people's right to protest in support of Gaza, in support of Palestine, in support of action for Palestine with a lowercase a and a capital P. Their problem, they say, is with the group itself. And therefore, they are, in line with that legislation, arresting people who express support for what they consider to be a terrorist group, in the same way that you would be arrested if you went on a protest or a rally or whatever it happened to be, and you held up a sign saying, "I support Al-Qaeda," or "I support ISIS," or whatever it happens to be. But therein, I suppose, lies the problem, which is that for terrorism legislation to be considered effective, you've got to have buy-in from the public that the group in question is clearly a terrorist organization. No one clearly would have a problem with arresting people who had a placard up and said that they were supporting Al-Qaeda or that they were supporting back in the day the IRA, or they were supporting ISIS, or wherever it happened to be. Because there is widespread buy-in from the public that these are terrorist organisations. The problem, it seems to me here, is the government has not adequately explained why it is that Palestine Action is a terrorist organisation. That doesn't mean that they're not. But they haven't adequately explained it. Indeed, in that same article, the Home Secretary said that there are things that I cannot tell you and will never be able to tell you to explain why it is that Palestine Action is a terrorist organisation. Now, that might be fine. Maybe she's right. But in the absence of sharing at least some of that information, then all people see is television pictures of old ladies and people who are clearly protesting peacefully being hauled away into police vehicles. And the danger with that is that it makes a mockery of the terrorism legislation overall. And it simply looks like, whether this is the case or not, it is credible to argue that the government is simply trying to crack down on dissent. And that cannot be a good place for a government, any government, to be. What do you think about this? Do you think that it is right the government have banned this group? Or is there a danger, as I say, of them potentially creating a situation where they are just making their own laws look ridiculous by arresting people who are protesting peacefully? And can we really be in a society that's a democracy when you've got 700 people being arrested for simply holding up a placard? 0345 6060 973. First of all, let's talk to James Matthewson, former Labour Party spokesperson. James, were you surprised by that figure of 70% of Labour Party members opposing the action?
No, not at all. It's one of these things which the writing's been on the wall for some time. Anybody who's been in or around the Labour Party knows that it has a history of strong Palestinian support. When it comes to this legislation and the use of it, this is unprecedented. I mean, especially from a Labour government. Under Tony Blair's darkest days of the Iraq War, we didn't see this legislation or legislation like it. And granted that it didn't exist in its current form, but, you know, we didn't see this kind of crackdown on people trying to protest against even the British government's actions. So what Palestine Action have done, and look, I can't come on here and support them, obviously, but it makes sense to see so many people being outraged by this, not just in the Labour Party, but the wider Labour movement, which has a stake in this government. Of course it does.
What do you make of the argument which says that the Home Secretary has been putting forward, which says, look, they have been involved in not just protests, but multiple incidents of direct action against military installations like Bryce Norton, and that there are things that we don't know that she knows, that given that she's received the advice to prescribe them, she had no choice but to do.
It feels lazy to me to say there's things that I know that you'll never know. I understand that is the nature of her position, and that of course there's information that we'll never be able to receive. But I just do not believe that anything that would be so damaging that the government wouldn't seek to use it as an excuse. You know, if it was so damaging and they were able in some way to share it, then we would have heard about it. We would have heard about it. And there isn't a single person, by the way, in support of this group or in support or against the actions of the government, if you like, who are saying that you shouldn't prosecute these people. These people should be prosecuted, right, under the crimes that they've committed.
And there's no doubt they have committed crimes. There is no doubt about that. We should be very clear.
Undoubtedly they've committed crimes. They, you know, many of them have pleaded guilty to that. However, it's about the use of the legislation that is used very specifically to protect us from terrorism. And terrorism has a very, very clear international definition. The government doesn't just stand on shaky moral ground here, to put it, you know, nicely. It stands internationally in a very, very difficult position, because it will open itself up to all sorts of legal action from all sorts of international human rights lawyers about this, if it keeps, as I fear it will, going down this path.
What do you think is the effect, just to narrow it down a little bit, onto an issue of secondary importance, but nonetheless it is politically important, the effect within the Labour Party itself? As someone who knows the Labour Party well, what would you say is the sort of state of play with regards to this issue within Labour? Because it continues to be toxic, doesn't it?
It does. And what happens with these issues in the Labour Party, which, you know, I don't need to explain to you, you're a student of it, you've watched it over the years, you know that this happens. People either double down, right, internally, and they think, I'm going to support the leadership, I'm going to stay quiet, I'm going to go... Or they split and they completely break off, as people have done. Look, members don't win general elections. I understand that. I was, you know, under the Corbyn leadership, I know, I've seen that firsthand. But you will lose members over this. You will lose supporters. And crucially, this is an issue that permeates class, race, and all sorts of divisions in Britain. There are many, many people of all sorts of backgrounds, social, economic backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, who support this ability to come out on the streets and campaign, and many of them who support direct action in certain ways. They just don't want to see terrorist legislation used wrongly, because especially when you've got groups like Britain First, right? You've got groups like Britain First, whose members have driven vans at people who would do Nazi salutes in the street.
I was going to say this, James. I would say, to me, one of the biggest dangers of this, whatever you think about the prescription itself, the effect of what's happening with all of these people being arrested who are clearly non-violent, feels to me like one of the biggest dangers is that the far-right provocateurs of this world, not even going to name them, but people know exactly who I'm talking about, sort of go online and they say, look, here we are. What have we been saying all these years? This is what the British state does. If they don't like someone, they lock them up under spurious pretenses. Now, again, we can have the argument about the rights or wrong of that, but it does leave that door ajar for them to do that, doesn't it?
Of course it does. Look, and all I want from libertarians on the far right is to see consistency. Because we don't see this with American ones. We certainly don't see it with British ones. Because when it comes to somebody like Lucy Connolly being arrested, right, they're all up in arms. Somebody who called for the firebombing, you know, of asylum hotels, they're up in arms about it. But the second you see a priest holding a placard saying they support a certain group, then they're all in support of it. It just doesn't make sense. People are doing this across partisan lines, and it's very clear why they're in support of it. And like you say, there are these groups that you look at who are very, very clearly inclined towards violence across the political spectrum, who are not receiving this treatment. So it's very clearly an issue about Gaza. It's this desire to try and look strong, whether it be to Israel, whether it be to America, whoever. And unfortunately, the Labour Party, it walks down this path at its peril.
Just one other thing, James, since you mention it, and you mention your association with the Corbyn era of the Labour Party. And I know you've written about, there's all this talk about this new party, your party. I know you've written saying that to be very, very wary of this idea. Where do you think that is up to now? And what did you make of, I don't know if you saw yesterday, Zara Sultana's comments that she thought that one of the problems for the in the Corbyn period is they capitulated on this charge of anti-Semitism. What did you make of that?
Yeah, look, it's very difficult. Zara Sultana worked in the Labour Party around the same time I did, as well as a kind of community organiser. So she knows that period. And I was disappointed to hear it because, look, I'm on the left. My politics haven't changed. For me, it's about pragmatism, about who can lead us best. However, there were issues of anti-Semitism, and there were incidents of anti-Semitism. I saw them, I witnessed them, other people did as well, and that breaks my heart. I don't want there to be on the left at all, of course I don't. However, to completely try and push that under the carpet, as Jeremy previously did, and had to come around on eventually, or sort of came around on, it just seems really disappointing that we would repeat those mistakes of the past. But we should be saying, let's put all that behind us, let's get some kind of leadership on the left that can bring everyone together, whether it be, I don't know, Zach Polanski in the Green Party seems to be a great figure. There's all sorts of people on the left. I just don't want to rehash the mistakes of yesterday.
She was talking, of course, and of course this world is really resurrecting things from the past, but she said that he had capitulated to the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, saying it equated it with anti-Zionism.
Yeah, and this is going to be a bone of contention. And this is why I do not think it is in Zara Sultana, Jeremy Corbyn, anybody attached to that project. I don't think it's in their interest to try and dredge this back up. They should leave it lying where it is right now and try and deal with the issues of today. This is still one of them. Look, Israel uses anti-Semitism as a shield to try and guard itself from its own crimes, all right? But there is a fine line. We still have to be aware of that, and we have to walk it carefully. But I just do... My piece in the Eye paper was about that, and about the concern that we are just going to try and rerun projects passed, and I don't think that's to anyone's benefit.
James Matthewson there, former Labour Party spokesperson in the Corbyn years, really interesting piece he wrote in the Eye paper about this suggestion of a new left party. I do want your thoughts on Palestine Action, though. In particular, I can understand as well, in this era where we're talking about shoplifting being on the rise and petty theft being on the rise and so on, again, that incongruity when people see the police cracking down on a few hundred protesters who are demonstrating peacefully but can't arrest or can't sort out, you know, shoplifting or petty crime in their local area. You know, are we getting our priorities right here? What does it say about Britain and Britain's democracy that you can get arrested for holding up a placard saying you support a certain group? 0345 60 60 973, 0345 60 60 973. Do you support the prescription of Palestine Action? The time is 11:19.
The all-new LBC app. News your way. Download it for free from the App Store. This is LBC.
Keeping your smile healthy. At Darwood and Tanner, it's our sole purpose and absolute obsession. Whether you're missing a single tooth or many teeth, our streamlined patient journey, world-class dental practitioners, and advanced implant technology will get you smiling again quicker, more comfortably, and in the least invasive way. Darwood and Tanner. For our most comprehensive, tailored, and complete dental implant treatment, visit darwoodandtanner.co.uk.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, drop up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Get a step closer to winning a huge £20,000. Enter now at winplus.co.uk. Winplus, great prizes, real winners. 18 plus, GB only, T's and C's apply.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus, GB only, while stocks last. Terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 60 60 973.
Time is 11:20. Just a quick update on the story we were talking about in the last hour, which is, of course, Ukraine. Vladimir Zelensky has tweeted in the last half an hour or so confirming that the Allies were, quote, already working on the concrete content of the security guarantees. Today, we continue coordination at the level of the leaders. There will be discussions. We're preparing the relevant formats. We're also continuing working tomorrow. National security advisors are in constant contact now. Quotes, there will be security guarantees. I thank all our partners for their determination and support. Ukraine feels this strength. This is, of course, as Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron are prepared to co-chair the coalition of the willing meeting today. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson also posting about getting ready for a series of calls in the coalition of the willing. The pressure on Russia must increase, the Swedish Prime Minister has said. I emphasize this in every conversation. We'll, of course, keep you up to date with developments over the course of the day on LBC. We're talking about Palestine Action for the moment, though, and whether it is right that the government has prescribed and what it says about British democracy that it has been. Rog Chadha is criminal defense lawyer from the firm Hodge, Jones and Allen. They've represented Palestine Action in their legal troubles. Raj, thanks so much for joining us this morning. This is a very unusual situation, isn't it?
It's extraordinarily unusual, unprecedented that a group which it has accepted targets, or certainly does not target violence against individuals, has been prescribed.
The Home Secretary argues that the advice she has received from the systems in place designed to assess these threats have recommended their prescription, that she would be an irresponsible Home Secretary were she not to therefore carry out that recommendation. And indeed that the group has committed acts of violence against British military installations, and that there are things, security details, which she cannot divulge, but argues strongly mandate their prohibition. What's your response to that?
Well, firstly, obviously, these matters are being challenged in court, and the High Court will convene in November to review these matters. But certainly, past attempts to prescribe Palestine action have always been met by the government with statements saying that they do not meet the very high threshold that relate to prescription. And the terrorism has a very, very wide definition in UK law. It does include violence against property or damage to property, but that in itself does not mean it should be prescribed.
Well, the Terrorism Act defines terrorism to include serious damage to property carried out for political ends. Now, your clients have openly admitted to breaking into factories, damaging sites, even RAF bases. If we applied a different standard to them rather than, say, a far-right or Islamist group who damage infrastructure for their causes, that would be a double standard, surely, when we probably would apply that standard to those groups.
But no group has been prescribed at all in the 25 years of the Terrorism Act for damage to property alone. The groups that have been prescribed, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and so on, relate to violence against individuals.
But when activists break into RAF bases or arms factories, there's a real risk to those workers, the security staff, or even to themselves, isn't there? So how can you just... That could easily lead to harm.
But it depends on what the group's intentions are. And also, it's a discretion on the Home Secretary and what the consequences of prescription are. I heard your previous conversation with the previous speaker. If there is acts of violence or issues in relation to particular incidents, then evidence can be reviewed and they can be prosecuted. The effect of prescription is something quite different. The effect of prescription, as we have seen, is that if you hold a placard up, you can be arrested. In a mature democracy, that cannot be right.
And in terms of what will happen to those people, I'm unfamiliar with the sanction they might face. What sort of sanction might those people end up receiving just for the act of, say, holding up a placard saying you support this prescribed group?
So there are three individuals that have been charged to date. They've been charged under Section 13 of the Terrorism Act, and the maximum sentence is 6 months imprisonment.
6 months.
6 months. There is a further provision under Section 12 of the Terrorism Act in which you are inviting support, and it is possible that some people might be charged under that. That is 14 years imprisonment maximum.
14 years? How likely is it anyone might receive anything like that? Surely quite unlikely.
It's really difficult to say what the prosecuting authorities are going to do.
Because this hasn't happened very often before.
This hasn't happened before. The three that have been charged have been charged under Section 13. But what's really going to happen also is there's a real chilling effect. You've seen people being arrested for carrying an excerpt of Private Eye on a placard. You've seen people being arrested for saying Plasticine Action, free animation from AI. This is quite a bizarre set of circumstances for the UK to find itself in.
So what we're learning here, I'm sure this wasn't news to you, Mr. Chadha, but we're learning, the public more generally, that the Terrorism Act is a very widely defined piece of legislation which gives a great deal of discretionary power to the Home Secretary of the day to define what constitutes terrorism and what does not.
That's exactly the position. And really, the Home Secretary should think about her responsibility to exercise that discretion with caution rather than jump in the way that she has done.
Raj Chadha there, criminal defence lawyer from the firm Hodge, Jones and Allen, who have represented Palestine Action. Let's turn to Mark in Uppingham, who I think has a different view. Mark, good morning. Are you there, Mark? He was stunned into silence. Perhaps not. Perhaps he isn't there. Maybe we can turn to James, who's in Tower Hamlets instead, and we'll see if we can get Mark in Uppingham back. James, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Well, what a relief.
I would like to say that I disagree with that lawyer from Hodge, Jones and Allen, and I do know Hodge, Jones and Allen very well.
Right.
I
hope for positive reasons.
Because I'm also in the legal arena.
Ah, okay, fine. Well, why don't you give us your alternative take, James, because that's helpful.
Well, the Home Secretary, no government rushes as quick as this to prescribe any organisation. Now, I would take the Home Secretary's word that she has been presented evidence from the intelligence community which has led them to recommend that this organisation be prescribed.
Right.
Now, we don't know what the intelligence is. I know we're in this, we want answers straight away. Why did you do that? We demand answers, because that's the kind of society we're living in today. But I don't need to know what the intelligence picture is.
Well, you might.
I don't need to know that.
Well, okay, James, and I respect that. But there are clearly lots of people who do want to know, and there are lots of people who...
There's lots of people. They may want to know, but the whole point about intelligence.
But we live in a James. We live in a democracy.
It doesn't matter if you live in a democracy.
Well, it sort of does.
There are certain things. Look. If the intelligence services were going to come out and say, "Well, people want to know this," we better tell them. You could put agents at agents.
So if the intelligence services, the intelligence services came along and said, "Well, we're going to arrest your neighbour, we're going to arrest the neighbour next door, and so on, because we've got intelligence." I'm sorry, we can't tell you who that is. You'd be fine. Always trust the intelligence services.
Listen, I don't need to know what that intelligence is. Okay. It's none of my business. I'm not in the intelligence community.
I think on these issues
where we know that an organization has broken into military bases, has damaged military aircraft, that is an act of domestic terrorism. Okay, it's not criminal damage, like going down the street and daubing something on a window. That was planned action, not direct action. Direct action is completely different, okay? Now, direct action could be demonstrating outside of a bank because you don't want it funded the arms industry.
Well, that's a protest. Different to direct action.
But what they've done, they broke into a military base.
Sure.
They've caused significant amount of damage to British military equipment. Mm-hmm. That's not direct action. That's domestic terrorism.
Are we really putting them on the same? On the same level as Al Qaeda and ISIS and the IRA? I mean, to most people, that would seem ridiculous.
What you have to do is look at their motivations, what's behind them.
But they don't want to hurt anyone. Terrorism surely is about hurting people. They don't want to hurt anyone.
It's not necessarily about hurting people. You need to look at their motivations. What are the motivations behind this group? Is it to demonstrate against Israel and what Israel's doing in Gaza? And I don't for one minute condone what Israel's doing in Gaza, but I wouldn't go breaking into a British military base to damage aircraft, because I can go to prison for that, okay?
Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose on that basis, though, if we're just talking about sort of form of direct action, then would we ban Just Stop Oil? Because they basically just take action against, like, the M25?
They're in a slightly different arena, okay? Yes, they go on top of gantries and they're causing a nuisance to the public. And the people who've done that have been sent to prison, okay? Mm. They have, right?
Yeah, but they haven't been called terrorists.
Neither have they broken into a British military base and destroyed military equipment, okay? So there's a different categories of scale here, okay?
Yeah.
Now, this organization committed an act of domestic terrorism. Now, we don't know what the intelligence community have on this organization and the people behind this organization. Okay, because there's always someone behind it, and we don't know what their motivations are. But for all I know, the intelligence agencies could have people, operatives, work undercover in those organizations who are feeding in to the system, so you develop an intelligence.
But on your basis,
picture.
James, we'd probably have banned the Green and Common Women as terrorists. They were taking action against critical infrastructure, US military bases. Should we have prescribed the Green and Common Women?
I understand the Green and Common Women were campaigning. They were campaigning against the placement of nuclear weapons on Greenham Common. And yeah. I was listening to something about that the other day. They didn't go and damage equipment or anything like that. They were campaigning, and then they wanted that common land returned to the people.
They had mass blockades of the base gates. They climbed and cut through the fences to enter the site. They occupied runway to disrupt operations. So again, fine lines.
These are fine lines, but there's a difference between planning absolute willful destruction of British military equipment. That is an act of domestic terrorism.
Right.
It is a fine line.
All right.
So we don't know what the intelligence agencies said to the whole...
My point, James, I've got to go to the news. My point, James, would be that they need to release it, because you may trust the state and always not to misuse intelligence. I don't, particularly having sat through 2 years of a super injunction trial where the state basically lied consistently about what they knew and what they didn't. I really don't. So I think they need to be a bit more open. But anyway, grateful to you, James, for that alternative point of view. It's important. If you have any thoughts on any of that, 0345 6060973. Let's take a breather now. Get the LBC news headlines at 11:33 with Dominic Ellis.
LBC understands the head of Britain's armed forces is heading to the US for talks about American involvement in security guarantees in Ukraine. Donald Trump said last night that America is ready to coordinate guarantees in the event of a peace deal. Israel is yet to officially respond to a new plan by mediators for a ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted the proposal, which would involve the release of some Israeli hostages during a 60-day truce. And the government has refused to comment on reports that the Chancellor is considering a major reform of stamp duty. Instead, people who own and live in properties worth more than £500,000 could pay an annual tax. LBC weather, sunny spells for Wales, the southeast of England and the far west of Scotland. Some heavy rain developing for southern areas later, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from real Octopus Energy calls.
You just get it right, the customer service, the sort of communication. You've stepped it up, I think, for an energy company, so well done.
Octopus Energy, great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which? 8 years running.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals, verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny.
Oh.
Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 11:36. Few of your texts and WhatsApps on this. Sarah says, Lewis, re-Palestine action issue. Another massive Labour government misjudgment. Nonsense in the time of social media. Labour is just not really with the zeitgeist of 2025 because they're out of power for so long. Carl says, good morning, Lewis. If Palestine Action as an organisation meet the prescription criteria, they should be banned. How easy is it to say stop genocide, support Palestine? The inclusion of the word action detracts from Palestine. The people are being attracted to the protest and not the correct cause. That's Carl from Liverpool there. Just worth saying, I mean, it is true, as our lawyer was saying there, the Terrorism Act 2000, the definition of terrorism is very broad. It's set out in Section 1 and it boils down to this. I think it's just worth reading. Terrorism means the use or threat of action where one, the action involves one of the following: serious violence against a person, serious damage to property, endangering another person's life other than the person committing the act, creating a serious risk to the health or safety of the public or a section of the public, seriously interfering with or seriously disrupting an electronic system. So on that basis, to be fair, the Home Secretary is completely within her rights to call a group a terrorist organisation, because the legislation is very broad And it also includes a use or threat is designed to influence the government, international government or organisation. The use or threat is made for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, racial or ideological cause. So on that basis, they definitely fit the criteria. The question is whether the Home Secretary ought to have come to a different decision using her discretion because of the basis of what's happened. Let's speak to Farah, who's in Southfields in West London, southwest London. Farah.
Hi. So my concern is really, it's really dangerous to make assumptions on both sides in the absence of hard evidence. I'm concerned about the people who've been arrested getting a fair trial. And my worry is that if the Home Secretary, you know, comes out with something really explosive, it could prejudice a jury. Then the people don't get a fair trial, potentially a miscarriage. And what I think possibly they're, you know, the government's afraid of is a legal challenge to, you know, prescribe the group. I was at the National March on the same day. I actually didn't know that there was this protest going on. I only noticed as I walked up to Westminster, and I could see a lot of police in, you know, kind of riot formations. And you never get that. You get perfectly relaxed policemen on these marches most of the time. So that's kind of my concern. I want to know, I'm very much, you know, stand in solidarity with Palestine, but I think truth is really important and Labour haven't handled this very well. You know, you can't just say, I know something that you don't know and I can't ever tell you.
Yeah.
With all these other terrorist groups, they've said they were plotting to blow up this or they were plotting to blow up that. And that came out quite quickly. And, you know, I'm 49. I remember all the IRA, you know, planned terrorist attacks and all everything that came out. And it came out a lot faster. So right now, the public can just see, and also a real miscalculation with rolling in Palestine action with two, I think they were neo-Nazi terrorist Russian groups, in the vote. So that just looks, it looks really bad. It just looks like they're manipulating the system. Because there were plenty of Labour MPs said that they wouldn't have voted for Palestine action to be prescribed. But they, had they not voted on, you know, then the other two wouldn't have been. So it just looks really dodgy.
What would you like to see the Home Secretary do there for Farah?
There must be something that she can tell us. There must be, because they're not going around killing people, so there must be something.
Yeah.
Or manage it in a different way. It's a really difficult question because...
It is difficult.
Because, you know, I just think making assumptions in the absence of evidence is... It's just not smart. And I'm worried about our right to protest, obviously. So there's a lot of speculation going on. And there must be something she can tell us saying they are being accused of an alleged plot or whatever it may be. So, yes, people know. But then they then go in as jurors and they have to see the evidence. And whatever this evidence is, the hard evidence, then it gets discussed. And then, you know, you don't get 83-year-old grannies and a blind man in a wheelchair being arrested. I saw the look on the face of the police with some of them around that area, and they just really did not look comfortable. You know, can you imagine being a policeman having to...
Very difficult.
They have to enforce...
Not what they went into the police force for, I'm sure. Farah, grateful to... I mean, maybe the answer to this as well is that you prescribe the group, but it is not a criminal offence to express support for them in that way. I mean, I suppose that could lead to other outcomes where... You know, people are expressing support for far less savoury groups. I don't know. But nonetheless, this seems a bit of a flaw overall in the legislation. Paul is in Marazion in Cornwall, of course. Paul.
Marazion.
I always wonder. I've been there and I always wonder how it's pronounced. And I've learned something today, Paul. Marazion, forgive me. Lovely place, lovely part of the world. Paul, what do you think about this?
Arresting the old people carrying placards and that. It's nonsense, or maybe it's not nonsense. Give them a fine and maybe stick a tag on their ankle for 3 months or something. But
or a warning, Just something.
They need a slap on the wrist and be told to behave themselves.
Yeah.
But the actual group, they are terrorists in my view. It's not just the attack on the planes at Bryce Norton. They've been attacking that Israeli company Elbit Systems. Where they injured police officers and whatever and drove a car through the warehouse doors and whatever. And there's various other ones. There was one in Brighton where they smashed through the roof with hammers and whatever.
I think you're alluding to the point that I've come to in the course of this conversation, actually, Paul, which because I was a bit unsure about it. But I think that kind of, look, I think it feels to me like The prescription itself, it feels a bit borderline. I mean, they're clearly not Al-Qaeda. They're clearly not ISIS. It's not that level. But I can see the argument. Look, they are targeting, you know, UK government military installations for a political purpose. I could see how that could lead to harm. So I can see the argument for it. But the argument for locking up 700 people for putting up a placard saying you support them, it feels very, very dubious to me.
Well, that's nonsense, and it almost certainly isn't going to happen, and we haven't got 700 prison spaces.
We haven't got the space for them.
No, they need a wrap on their knuckles, maybe stick a tag on their ankle for 3 months, and then just, you know, but they're well-meaning people, but I think they're just, they're just not right in when they're supporting people who are doing that sort of damage.
All right, Paul, grateful to you. Steve is in Penn in Buckinghamshire. Steve, your thoughts on this?
Hi, Lewis. Yes, I attended a protest on Saturday in High Wycombe. Well, it's actually in Knaphill. It was a Stop the War coalition.
Right.
Full of, people from all ages, from 3 to 4 years of age up to 70, 80, and possibly beyond. It was the most benign, peaceful crowd you could wish for. I can't understand, because we were talking about it, the ban, what the difference is. Why have they got banned for being terrorists? Oh, can I quickly say as well, Lewis?
Yes.
And for me, it's really important. The local police were fantastic. And they let us demonstrate right up to the boundary fence, a strike command. Incredibly.
But I suppose the argument, Steve, would be, why can't you, obviously, there are very, very many people who want to express their solidarity and disgust with what's happening in Gaza.
Yes.
But then there's no one stopping you from doing that. What you don't do is hold up a placard saying that you support a proscribed organisation, which has become a terrorist organisation. So I suppose the argument would be, why not just hold up a placard saying, I support Gaza? You don't have to say, I support Palestine Action.
True, and I don't think there was any placards there saying that. In fact, I'm sure there wasn't. But it was just like, it seemed to be like the same group of people. So I can't understand why one's got banned and we on a Saturday never got arrested or anything like, and no threat of it at all. What I'm trying to say is, why ever have they been banned?
Well, the Home Secretary says it's because of the military action that they've committed. Anyway, Steve in Penn, grateful to you. We'll continue this conversation after the break. You're listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC. The time is 11:45.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The government is, we're told, paving the way for the state pension age to be raised to 70 as a review considers tying future increases to life expectancy.
Torsten Bell is the pensions minister and Labour MP for Swansea West.
Do you ever see a time when the state pension is means tested?
Well, absolutely not. That's a mad idea. The only person that suggested that is Kemi Badenoch. It's a lunacy. I'm sure you're putting into a private pension.
I am, and you're coming for it.
Wait, I'm not coming for it. That's a ridiculous thing to say. You're going to put my private pension,
whatever's left of it maybe in the future. Well, if I want to give that to my children, you're going to put that in, roll that into inheritance.
Absolute madness.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. Top up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. Inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Hey mum, so you know we met Zara, my financial advisor? Yeah, from St. James's Place. Well, she drafted our plan so you can get that bungalow near me. Oh, and Sam, that lovely carer we found, will drop in. And I can bring over my signature shepherd's pie. Oi!
Big decisions call for invaluable advice.
Visit St James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips?
Sometimes, pal, your best bet is not to bet at all. And BetVictor's app makes it really easy, simple and safe to do so. They've got lots of helpful features to help you manage your time and your spend online. But it also really helps that I can't find my blooming phone half the time.
Yeah, that does really help.
I don't even know where it is now. I can hear it, but I can't see it. Sandra?
Listen to Harry and please gamble responsibly. 18+ gambleaware.org.
Global Player is home to fantastic podcasts like The Sports Agent. Join Gabby Logan and Mark Chapman as they take you inside the action as football returns for one of its biggest seasons yet. With last-minute winners, transfer sagas and behind-the-scenes secrets. You've seen it happen. Now find out why. The Sports Agent with Gabby Logan and Mark Chapman. Listen now on Global Player.
Leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time has just turned 11:49. Let's speak to Geraint, who's in Chester. Something to say about Palestine action. Geraint, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. I think it's very selective, these arrests, because the UVF, which is a terrorist organisation, which has murdered people, they were at an Orange Order event back in July. There was no arrest done. Correct me if I'm wrong there. Now, why were there no arrests done? Because obviously the police, probably Yvette Cooper, realised that the blowback or the hassle from arresting some of those members, potential murders, in fact, in retaliation, was probably not worth the hassle. So, you know, but that's a prescribed terrorist organisation that was left alone.
Well, the UVF has been prescribed since the 1970s, a long time.
Yeah, and, I mean, they've got multiple murders and bombings, including on British soldiers as well, in fact. But
I think this is the problem, Geraint. It's the discretionary element, isn't it? When people don't understand why a group, when they're not familiar with it and they don't understand why it's been prescribed, it's ultimately, you know, as we say, policing is always basically done in Britain on consent. And this is just another form of policing, albeit at a very high level and about politics. So it is difficult. It makes it difficult to sustain.
Well, one thing that always gets me, though, is that, they're always talking about terrorism in regards to the Middle East. Let's not forget that people in the Israeli government, like Ben-Gavir, are convicted terrorists. Like, he literally threatened to murder Yitzhak Rabin, and a week later, Yitzhak Rabin was murdered. It's just, you know, as one example, and it's very selective, find.
Geraint.
And I think... Sorry, I was whittering on.
No, you weren't whittering at all. And I think you've actually put your finger on the nub of the issue. So grateful to you, Geraint, in Chester there. I want to just turn back to Ukraine briefly. This coalition of the Willing Call apparently is underway right now. That's something basically confirmed by Poland's Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister. He said today that the call is going on, stressing the importance of Poland's role in providing support for Ukraine. He said the dynamics have accelerated. The last hours and days show how crucial a movement this is for the world and for Europe. So that call of the so-called Coalition of the Willing being co-chaired by our own Prime Minister Keir Starmer, the French President Emmanuel Macron, underway right now. Let's turn to Arya Shahrukh-Shahi, the British filmmaker who's been living in Ukraine for the past 6 years, now volunteers on the front lines to get a sense of what life is like there at the moment. Arya, thanks so much for joining us this morning. How do you think this is going down the last 24 hours in Ukraine?
Hello, thank you very much for having me. I think it's a vital time for Ukraine. I think it's important to clear up some of the language that's being used. You know, I think it's easy to talk about the main points in terms of land swap, in terms of security guarantees. But what does that all mean? I think that it's important to understand that the current amount of occupied territory in Ukraine is about 90% of the entire of England. And it's easy to talk about just swapping land, but, you know, these are people's lives, their homes. It's nearly a quarter of a million.
And the bit of Donetsk, sorry to interrupt, the bit of Donetsk that Putin wants Ukraine to just hand over that he's not even been able to seize is, I think, about 6 to 7 times the size of Greater London.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I'm based in Kramatorsk, which is in the east of Ukraine, which is...
that's a bit he wants.
Exactly, yeah. Kramatorsk, Slovyansk. And these are incredibly important territories and incredibly important logistical places for Ukraine, not only in terms of what they represent, but also militarily for protecting the country from further aggression.
You've spent time on the front lines. Give us a sense of what the state of play is and what that is like.
I mean, yeah, for the past 3.5 years, I've been working in the east of Ukraine. The situation is absolutely dire. If you had told me 3.5 years ago that I would see the amount of devastation, the amount of loss, the amount of death, children being pulled out of rubble with their parents watching. A friend of mine, a British guy, Eddie, our car was hit with a drone only a few months ago. And he lost his arm and his leg. You know, I think it's important that we understand who we're talking about when we're talking about the Russians, and the Russian Federation and their army is brutality. It's pure brutality. So I think it's really important to note that out. It's a devastating war, with huge loss, on both sides, but especially in the Ukrainian side, with the amount of civilian casualty and the amount of war crimes that are just continually taking place.
Do you think that is what Trump says he wants to try and stop? Do you think Ukrainians and do you yourself buy the idea of him as some sort of peacemaker?
Whether he's a peacemaker or not, we'll have to see. I think actions speak louder than words. What is peace if Ukraine doesn't come out in a good in a good way? Like, if we just look back at the Budapest Memorandum, you know, that was supposed to be a peace supported by the US, supported by the UK, supported by Russia, that promised to respect Ukraine's independent sovereignty and its existing borders, that pledged no threat, use against force, no economic coercion. And look what happened, and look where we are.
Aria Shari there, British filmmaker, living in Ukraine, in the east of Ukraine for the past 6 years, now volunteering on the front lines, giving us a sense of what life is like in the east at the moment. Let's turn back to the conversation on Palestine action. John is in Edinburgh. John, good morning. You've got a thought about this.
Yeah, I do. Interesting chat. This is a constitutional issue. It shows how badly we're served by not having a written constitution.
I agree. I completely agree with that.
It means the Home Secretary can decide whatever she wants to do. She has all the rights and you have none.
Yep.
And that is... No other country with a written constitution would act in this uncivilized way.
Well, quite.
I should say that Britain has written 52 constitutions for other countries since the Second World War, because it's important, obviously, but never thought for one moment that it would need one. Well, and this is a classic example.
Well, I completely agree. And you can even argue that, frankly, you know, when citizens have got to consult old pieces of legislation like the Terrorism Act, which were obviously drafted by Parliament, Parliament is sovereign, it can basically confer whatever rights toward the Home Secretary that it so chooses, when it is so unclear exactly what even terrorism might mean in those circumstances, because we don't have a written constitution, that itself is a problem.
It's a huge, huge problem. I mean, we have a thing where they might turn around and say, anybody not acting in the interest of the British state is by definition a terrorist. Now, you and I would disagree with that, but a Home Secretary could take that view.
Indeed so, and I think that's exactly a problem. Another problem well identified. John in Edinburgh there. James is in Regent's Park. James, are you in the park or living in Regent's Park?
I'm in the park.
Oh, well, oh good.
It's a beautiful day.
I'm glad to hear that. James, your views on this?
I am absolutely disgusted with these people. They have damaged a military aircraft and put at life, risked the lives of our air pilots and other personnel. They should get the full force of the law. And these people that are supporting Palestinian action should be imprisoned and fined heavily. Instead of sitting there with their stupid placards saying they support this terrorist action, they should be sitting there saying, please free the hostages, the Israeli hostages, and outlaw Hamas.
Well, James, they can protest about whatever they like. I mean, you think, might think that they should be protesting about something else, but it's up to them what they protest about, isn't it?
Well, if they're breaking the law, no, it's not. And it's the best... I'm very pleased that Yvette Cooper has introduced this law. It's about time the government displayed some firm action on these people who are supporting Hamas and terrorist action.
Well, no, they would say that they were not supporting Hamas. They would say that they were trying to oppose what they think is a genocide.
Well, they're totally wrong. There's no genocide going on in Israel. Well,
there are lots of credible people, including lawyers, who believe that there is the most powerful army in the world. Right. Well, I think a lot of people would find that risible.
Would you? What about the Russian army when they attacked Berlin? Do you think they acted morally?
I'm not sure we should be engaging in whataboutery with regards to the Second World War, which was the most brutal conflict this earth has ever seen.
Well, what do you think any war is?
Well, you just said it was the most moral army in the world.
I'm saying the Israeli army is the most moral army.
There have been well-documented examples, James, of children being shot on the way to get food. You think that's moral?
Well, when you say well-documented, do you have any evidence other than saying?
Yeah, journalists operating within Gaza. We've had international organisations like the UN documenting it. Yeah, there's lots of evidence, James. I'm sorry that you won't open your eyes to it. I'm not saying...
Been shot by James, Hamas.
James. Like, this is the problem. I would argue, I would be very, very happy to talk about the nuances of this situation and the long nuances and difficulty of this around this historic conflict. But closing your eyes and just saying that this army is the most moral in the world and that the Israeli government is basically committing no wrong, this is crazy. This is crazy. That's just shutting your eyes to the facts in front of us. We've all seen the television pictures of starving kids. It's not right. That's not a moral act. And you can't seriously be arguing that it's a moral act.
The truth is beauty.
What? Is George Orwell on the line?
Don't you know that saying? Beauty is truth. Truth is beauty.
All right. James, who might not be in the Regent's Park, but I think he's in the Ministry of Truth, on the line there. James in Regent's Park. We're going to move on now and talk about something a bit closer to home. The Treasury is considering a new tax on the sale of homes worth more than £500,000, as steps towards a radical overhaul of stamp duty and council tax. That's according to reporting in The Guardian. This is as the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, prepares the ground for tax rises in this autumn's budget. Senior ministers tasking officials to study how a new proportional property tax could be implemented. Is this a good idea to have a new form of property tax? I would say, why don't we just tax all properties when they're sold? Do you really deserve the money from just sitting in your house and watching the bricks go up in value? I'm not so sure. 0345 6060 973.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, LBC understands the head of Britain's armed forces is heading to the United States for talks about American involvement in security guarantees in Ukraine. Donald Trump says America is ready to coordinate them in the event of a peace deal with Russia. It follows talks between Mr. Trump, Vladimir Zelensky and European leaders at the White House last night. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer described the summit as a significant step.
We've already instructed our teams to start tomorrow on setting out the detail with a view to completing this extra piece of work within a very short period of time. So for European security, for Ukrainian security and for our security in the United Kingdom, this is very important.
Sir Keir is due to chair a virtual meeting of the Coalition of the Willing to discuss next steps with leaders. Qatari and Egyptian mediators are waiting for a formal response from Israel about a 60-day ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted a US-backed plan in exchange for the partial release of some Israeli hostages. Israel has said it wants a comprehensive deal that would see all captives returned. Middle East correspondent Yotam Confino is following developments for LBC.
Israel would, according to this proposal, be allowed to keep a buffer zone around the Gazan border of roughly 800 to meter to 1 kilometer. So a solid buffer zone. And that's something that Hamas previously didn't want to agree to. But it looks like the military pressure on Hamas, with Israel about to enter Gaza City, is what has made them change their stance now.
The US says the UK has dropped its demand to be able to access the encrypted data of Apple users worldwide. The US Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, made the announcement on social media. In January, the government issued the tech firm with an order to share the information in the event of a national security threat. The Home Office has yet to comment. Wildfires are continuing to badly affect parts of Europe. Several large fires are continuing to burn in Macedonia, Croatia and in Spain. Temperatures of 45 degrees were recorded in Cadiz on Sunday. And it's understood the Chancellor Rachel Reeves is considering a major reform of stamp duty in England and Northern Ireland. Instead, people who own and live in properties worth more than £500,000 could pay an annual tax. The government says it won't comment, though, on speculation. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 20 at £91.77. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather. Sunny spells developing for large parts of the UK through the afternoon. Some heavy rain, though, for the southwest of England. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex, as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:04. Not every morning we hear a little bit of Keats on the radio, is it? Beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. So there we go. Let me let somebody say we don't bring you a little bit of culture here on LBC, thanks to our caller from Regent's Park. Seems to be completely wrong about everything else, but never mind. We're going to move on now, though, and talk about what the Chancellor is apparently proposing with regards to property tax. This is this story in The Guardian, which says that the Treasury is considering a new tax on the sale of homes worth more than £500,000 as a step towards a radical overhaul of stamp duty and council tax. So that would be replacing stamp duty, which is a stupid tax. Let us never even think anything else. It is a ridiculous tax to charge the people buying a property rather than those selling and who have made a profit on the property in the first place. But this is not exactly the change that I personally would like to see, but we can talk about that. This would basically be a tax, an annual tax, a bit like they have on in the United States, an annual property tax on properties worth over £500,000. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, asking officials to draw up proposals to study how a new proportional property tax could be implemented and model its impact before reporting back to ministers. Apparently, The Guardian's saying officials are examining a potential national property tax, which would replace stamp duty on owner-occupied homes. They're also studying whether, after the national tax, a local property tax could then replace council tax in the medium term in an effort to shore up local authority finances. No final decisions have been made, but if it were to happen, it would be one of the biggest changes to the tax base and the tax system, particularly if you brought in the council tax element that we've seen for many years. The national tax would basically be paid by owner occupiers on houses worth more than £500,000 when they sell their home. The amount paid would be determined by the value of the property, with a rate set by central government, which would directly collect the proceeds via HMRC. It would not replace stamp duty on second homes. This is something that would have to be worked in over some years. Bear in mind that the average price of a home in the UK is now around £270,000. The levy would affect about a fifth of property sales, compared with about 60% of current levels on stamp duty. So this would be a significant change, and it would be a change that would be clearly politically controversial, because taxes on property always are. For my part, look, I think that it is absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy that we have stamp duty. It is crazy to have a system where you are charging the people buying a house who have not profited whatsoever from the potential increases in the house price over the years, who have not profited from the profit, the margin that person has made, instead of taxing the seller. But I think Rachel Roof, so I think it's absolutely right she's looking at this. It is absolutely right. We need to be thinking more about how we charge wealth rather than income. We charge far too much or tax far too much on income rather than wealth in this country. I appreciate wealth taxation can be difficult. People who are wealthy can be mobile and so on. It has to be done properly. But there's welcome that the Treasury is thinking about this. For my part, I think what is crazy is not to charge, and I know lots of people won't like this, to actually tax on capital gains, apply capital gains tax when you sell your home. Why? Because frankly, you have done very little to, if anything, you have just sat there watching your home appreciate and appreciate and appreciate. And we are getting to the point now where the baby boomers are starting to sort of pass on the enormous increases in wealth, the enormous increases in wealth that we've seen when they downsize and so on, that they've seen in house prices over the years and property prices. And frankly, I'm not sure why we should have a tax system which basically incentivizes basically putting all of your money into just bricks and mortar where the value of it just goes up and up and up, but isn't doing much in terms of the innovation of the economy, the dynamism of the economy, isn't really incentivizing you to invest in things that actually might do something for the common good. As opposed to when we apply capital gains tax on investments that you might make or stocks or whatever it happens to be. Why is it that we basically say, oh, the value of your house that could have gone up 100% or 200% or 300% or whatever it is, that's fine. That's all yours. But then we tax it virtually. We tax work, we tax labor, we tax income, we tax all other forms of capital investment. But your own home, that's fine. And likewise, we don't dearly do nearly enough around inheritance tax either. So I think if the Chancellor is going to make a change to stamp duty, which I welcome, it will be better to be even more radical than she's suggesting. What do you think about that? Is it time that we have a big... What do you think, first of all, about this stamp duty proposal? Is it time we abolish it? What do you think of the Chancellor's proposal? But also, maybe we should be more radical still and we should be looking at actually just saying, let's have capital gains tax on your first home. 0345-6060-973, 0345-6060-973. Let's talk to Joe Wright, Policy and Advocacy Manager at Tax Justice UK. Even this proposal, Joe, good morning to you. Good afternoon to you, I should say now. It would be a radical change, wouldn't it?
It would certainly make a change. It would probably be one of the largest changes to property taxation since since council tax was introduced. It's really good that the government is starting to address the elephant in the room, which is the way we tax property and wealth in this country is fundamentally not working. For the reasons you've outlined very eloquently, stamp duty is a terrible tax that really basically causes huge amounts of problems in the property market. It's one of the reasons why an elderly person in a 5 or 6 bedroom house can't move, because they have to spend thousands and thousands of pounds in order to downsize by paying this tax. And we're also seeing the effects of council tax not working at all. Looking upward down the country, there are councils going bankrupt time and time again, largely regardless of who is running them, which political party. This is not because one party is running things badly any better than any others. It's because, frankly, the council tax is based on what property prices were 30 years ago. And councils have rising costs. They have to pay for adult social care. They have to pay for SEND provision. And central government has just cut their funding over the past 15 years. So it's clear that our approach to property tax is just not working. I think the problem with so I agree with everything you've just said, and this would be a welcome step. I think the problem is that this feels to me like a bit of a sticking plaster. So rather than sort of taking the bull by the horns and fundamentally overhauling the entire system so that it's fairer, this feels a bit like a sort of a temporary measure. So if we look at this proposal for additional taxation on homes worth more than 500,000, that might be a good thing. It will in practice mean just about everyone living in probably zones 1 to 4 in London, and most of the southeast will end up paying it.
Many I was going to say, people... it's basically a London tax, isn't it? Because the fact is that you'll be hard pressed to find many properties in London of any kind of size that are worth much less than £500,000. And with inflation, unless it were to go up, the threshold were to go up, then most of them will end up there.
That's absolutely the case. And given the government's sort of frozen, successive governments have often frozen tax thresholds, I suspect it will. Obviously this has not been brought into law yet, but I suspect it probably won't go up with inflation, and before long most people will end up paying this tax. So what the government, I think, should do is it should really grasp this perversely opportunity of councils facing financial ruin because our tax system isn't working, and introduce serious progressive tax reform. So, for instance, they could look at introducing a proportional property tax. I know that the report said that the government's possibly looking at this, and it would have to be done in a second term of a Labour government. I personally don't think that's true. They've still got 4 years left in this parliament, and that's how long the First World War lasted. We'd got quite a lot of stuff done then, and we didn't have computers. So I feel like, frankly, they could very easily do this. It would take time, obviously, and you want to do it properly, but you could introduce a proportional property tax within this parliament.
What would that look like when you talk about proportional property tax? What sort of thing do you mean?
So it would be based on the property's value. There are a few different proposals out there from groups like Onward and Fairer Share. So the specifics would look a bit different, but it would basically be a fixed percentage of the value of the property which you would pay in tax. So at the moment we have council tax bans, and this can mean if your property goes up from one ban to the next, you find your tax bill massively increases. So this can disincentivize you making improvements to it and that sort of thing. Whereas if it's a fixed percentage, then it doesn't, you're not going to get any dramatic tax rises overnight because you put in an extension or perhaps or something like that. So in practice, it'd be a fixed percentage at a relatively low rate. We're talking less than 1% now. And with those revenues, you would then could, for instance, abolish stamp duty entirely and abolish council tax and just have this one single.
Why not just put capital?
Tax?
Why not just put capital gains on property? I mean, the UK is relatively unusual in having no capital gains whatsoever above on any threshold. I mean, even the United States, which is hardly a socialist nirvana. many states do have some form or equivalent of capital gains above a certain threshold. Why don't we just do that?
Well, I think that's a good point. So what we're campaigning for is to go even further on capital gains tax. So I always use the example, if you earn £100,000 a year, which sadly I don't, but if you did, you pay about 40% income tax and national insurance contributions. If you earn that in capital gains, you pay half that. So I think we need to go, I agree with your point, and go further and equalize capital gains tax rates with incomes. To put simply, why should people be paying half the tax rates because their money comes from capital gains rather than through work? I think there's definitely a case for doing that.
Well, I suppose the argument historically has been, hasn't it, that people who are investing, that they're trying to incentivize investment and risk-taking, and therefore that's why capital gains is taxed less. But there is a strong argument, as you say, for at least some equalization.
Yeah, and what you find is that people will often, once you reach a certain level of wealth, you can often reclassify your income in different ways. So I think for a small business owner, they probably will be taking risks and doing entrepreneurial work and all the rest of it. But for a lot of the super wealthy, they'll have an accountant move their money around so that it appears as capital gains or whatever, when in fact it's no such thing. So I think there's a strong case for doing both. These aren't mutually exclusive options.
Just briefly, Joe, could you just explain why stamp duty is such a bad tax, the sort of distorting effects that it has?
So unlike, say, income tax or even your capital tax, which is typically quite low, you basically need to have a huge amount of cash readily available in your bank account in order to pay it. Your income tax is taken directly from your payslip, and council tax is on a monthly basis is a relatively low amount of money. To put it very simply, you need 20, 30 grand, however much it might be, depending on the house you're buying, just readily available in your bank account. And there's loads of bizarre things that don't make any sense. So you can't, for instance, just sort of bung it in and use the mortgage you're taking out to cover it. Now, why is that bad? Well, obviously it's bad because it means a lot of people might have saved up for the deposit, but then they've got to save up even more to pay this tax. It means that a lot of people can't get on the property market. It also means that a lot of people end up living in houses where they don't necessarily want to live anymore. So the classic example is the elderly couple or person who perhaps bought a house in somewhere in, say, South London that 40, 50 years ago might have been a fairly cheap and poor area. the house is now very, very expensive. They might want to downsize to somewhere that's more appropriate for their needs, but they can't because they've got to pay what is probably going to be the equivalent of several years worth of state pension in order to pay for the stamp duty. Obviously, there's a lot of people who just do not have thousands of pounds just sitting Indeed. In their bank account ready to go. So it has a hugely distorting impact on the housing market. It basically, yeah, it traps old people in the homes they're in now, and it traps young people out of the housing, out of being able to become a homeowner.
Joe Wright there, Policy Advocacy Manager at Tax Justice UK. What do you think about this? Do you think stamp duty ought to be abolished? I mean, as Joe was explaining there, it has all sorts of deeply weird effects. And to tax people who are buying rather than the people who have profited from appreciation in house prices is crazy and is unusual, but it does raise a lot of money, £11 billion. Do you agree with me that the best thing to do would just be to tax people on the profit they've made when they're selling their house? A profit that, to be honest, you haven't done anything to deserve. You've just sat there and watched your bricks and mortar appreciate in value. 0345 60 60 973. I've got a feeling a few of you might have something to say about that. It's Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien this morning. The time is 12:18.
This is LBC.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
Thanks for a lovely evening. Would you like to come in for a coffee?
Yeah, okay. That'd be lovely.
Oh, gosh, sorry. I didn't mean... I just wanted you to see my new Wix kitchen. It's just been installed.
At Wix, our experts will support you every step of the way, from a free kitchen design service through to a professional installation. Plus, with our spend and save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms and minimum spend apply.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. I inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 12:20. A few of your texts on this. Lewis, what if you have a mortgage? How are you supposed to afford the tax? You don't own the full value of the property. Well, that's why Shazia are under my system. You just pay it when you sold the property, so you don't have to worry about it. I agree with you. What Rachel Reeves is potentially proposing, I think, is more difficult. Paul says, sounds simple, but it only makes sense on new purchases. You can't fairly charge people annually if they've already paid stamp duty up front. Could unlock mobility, but risk market disruption. I can see that, Paul. I can definitely see that argument. It seems a bit unfair if you've paid a load of stamp duty and then you're charging an annual property tax as well. It's quite a lot to swallow. And Tony says, hi, Lewis, that tax will be ridiculous because you're at the mercy of market forces. If you have a house in London, you'll be paying more for someone who has an equivalent size house in Newcastle. It's not equitable. Again, Tony, you can imagine them coming up with a system maybe where it's more locally based. I think the proposal that apparently is coming through at the moment or being reported on, it would basically be a London tax because virtually all houses in London, houses for sure, would probably be very close to meeting it. So, yeah, I think that's fair. Lisa is in Croydon, who has something to say about stamp duty, I think. Lisa, good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis. Yeah, it's basically similar to the text that you've just had in that we've bought this year in the spring. So we paid stamp duty. So my heart kind of fell into my stomach when I heard that there's a potential possibility that we now might have to end up paying year on year again when it was a massive outlay. It was a carefully considered purchase, somewhere that we're looking to stay into past retirement. The mortgage goes past retirement, so we could be faced, depending on what the cost is, of having to move and downsize, which we really don't want to do. And we're in South London, so again, it does feel like a bit of a tax on the South, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think? I mean, what do you think of the idea of instead you could imagine a situation where you were to pay a tax based on the profit you make on the house.
I think that's a more sensible idea. I think stamp duty as a whole does need an overhaul.
How much did you pay in stamp duty, if you don't mind asking, Lisa?
We snuck in just before the deadline.
Right.
So
on the relief.
I can't remember the exact... Yeah, literally on the day.
Oh, really?
I can't remember the exact...
I reckon there were quite a few purchases made that day, I've got a feeling, Lisa.
Yeah.
A bit of a dip the day after.
Was tearing her hair out.
I bet. But it would have been, if it's a house in London, I mean, it would have been in the tens of thousands.
Yes, yeah. And we would come in just over the half a million limit, which, again, is like nails down a chalkboard to think that you have that kind of asset, because we're not rich people. Yeah. We are mortgaged to the hill. And like I say, that was a considered decision because we'd worked out our finances. But if we now get another bill thrown at us, that could be the bill that pushes us past affordability, which would be a real shame.
And
I don't think first-time buyers should be paying stamp duty at all ever.
Well, if you're a first-time buyer, I mean, there are reliefs for first-time buyers.
Yeah.
So the current, for example, on a £500,000 house at the moment, if you're not a first-time buyer in England and Northern Ireland, you'd pay £12,500. If you're a first-time buyer, you'd pay £3,750. So there has been relief for first-time buyers, but nonetheless, you know, every pound matters, and it is an enormous amount of money to just be able to find down the back of the sofa when you've got so many other costs involved.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Lisa in Croydon, grateful to you. Steve is in Newcastle. Steve.
Yeah. Lewis, I think we're probably going to disagree on this one, so I'm going to preface it by saying that I'm not a Tory, in fact, quite the opposite, and I taught until I retired and finished as acting head in a comprehensive school. However, I also invested in property, and on every penny I earned from teaching, I paid 40-odd percent.
Yep.
Every penny I earned from property, I paid a further 40%. Mm-hmm. Every repair I did on the house, I paid 20% VAT. When I sold a couple of houses, I paid 24% capital gains tax. And anything I've invested, I now pay 40% on that. I'm 71 years old, okay? I'm not pleading an age exemption, but I noticed that in your sort of swinging idea of changing all taxes, like Rachel Reeves, you dodge the big questions. You dodge, why are global corporations paying nothing? Amazon, for 2 years, have paid no UK tax. How much money have they made in the UK? Why aren't we dealing with that?
I don't think it's an either-or. I don't think it's an either-or, Steve.
Hang on. I agree. But have you heard Rachel Reeves or Keir Starmer or anybody show any backbone or guts? What they're going to do is another spiteful little tax. Oh, look, you've made a few bob on your house. We'll take it off you.
Well, to be fair, as a generation, Steve, the boomers have made more than a few bob off their house. billions and billions of pounds collectively, you know, just because, and this is where I think it gets difficult for younger people, partly because that same generation has decided to apply ultimately strict planning laws, which will prevent enough building to allow younger people to buy their house, which itself has increased the value of your home. So, let's have a little bit of equity.
Okay, you'll get no argument from me about ridiculous planning laws during my property investment period.
I'm sure you've experienced it. Yeah.
Well, every property I bought a renovation project, because that's what we did. We renovated them, put them into good order, and let them. And it worked very well, largely to students with whom we had, as both ex-teachers, we had a good relationship.
Yeah.
But the point I'm driving at is that, once again, it's a soft target. It's going for the small man who's got a few quid, and instead of saying, look, where's the real money? The real money is in Apple. It's in Amazon.
But there is a lot of real money in the appreciation of British property. There is real money in that.
There is,
Steve.
But again, what you're inviting is yet another attack on anybody who's made. We're not multimillionaires. We're a retired couple having fun and trying to do what we plan to do when we retire. I think I've made a fair contribution over the years.
I'm sure you have.
And I'm looking at Apple and Amazon, and they don't. And I want that address.
But everyone can always say someone else should pay. You know, ultimately, the tax base has got to be broad.
Yeah.
And even if we were able, which is difficult.
It's not.
But even if we were able, which will be difficult, to tax Amazon and Apple, when we both agree on this, the extent that they should be, that still would not be adequate to cover the taxation that we're going to need to cover an aging population and all the demands that people put on the state. So Reeves does have to look somewhere. And I suppose the argument, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I actually think what Reeves is suggesting is wrong, as I've outlined. I think there should be a more fundamental change. I think stamp duty, the abolition of stamp duty would be a very good idea, because it is a ridiculous tax to tax on purchase rather than sale. But if you were to put CGT on residences, at the moment, at least it would address the problem where you've got complete disparity between assets. At present, if you invest in, say, shares and make a profit, you pay capital gains. If you invest in your own property, make a profit, often far larger, you pay nothing at all. That skews investment towards property, which makes the housing crisis even worse. So my argument would be, why not change the system and have a property tax at sale, not at purchase, and not annually, and that would be an equitable, fair way of dealing with an asset which is appreciated a lot, which you may have invested in, sure, you keep most of the profit to it, but also a contribution is made.
So then, are we then going into a CGT scenario for stamp duty, where somebody says, hang on, I bought it for this, but, you know, I bought it for 200,000, but I spent another 200 taking it from a piece of wreckage into a decent property. So where is that going to be allowed for? Or presumably it isn't, would be my guess, under your system. And furthermore, anybody selling a house that is not their home pays CGT at 24%.
Sure,
okay?
Yeah.
So we're still, you know, we are paying.
Of course.
And the bit that I find horrifying, again, is that it's the sheer amount of tax.
But you are paying, but at the moment, what is happening is that the purchasers of property, who are often younger and don't have much capital, are being forced to raise, you know, significant capital to buy stamp duty on purchase. And my argument to you would be to say that, given that house prices, people who own those assets collectively, have gone up by literally trillions of pounds, that it would be more efficient, more equitable, more just to charge there rather than on purchase. And there's a generational equity impact on that as well.
I would go with the revision of stamp duty without a doubt, but I want to see a much broader taxation approach that is not just targeted at the easy targets, because the people that Rachel Reeves has got in her gun sights, we're the easy targets.
All right.
And that is the truth. All right.
All right, Steve. Well, we've had a good discussion. Lovely to talk to you as well, Steve, in Newcastle there. And look, none of this is easy, right? I mean, and it's always horrible. No one likes being taxed. Absolutely no one likes being taxed. Tony says, hi, Lewis, the tax will be ridiculous because you're relative market forces. Neil says, not everyone's house value rises. Those in London maybe, but the Northeast house, my house, is worth 44,000 less than what it's paid for it. Well, that's the beauty of the capital gain system that I'm proposing, Neil, is that if you haven't made a profit, then you don't pay it, because you can't tax a loss. Nigel says the wealthy can find many systems and afford to pay people to avoid tax. And that is, again, one of the ways in which I think the system would be fairer, because you can't move your house and you can't change the value of your house. Not very easily anyway, unless you decide to just, you know, knock it into a million pieces. And so therefore, it's an easy way for the Treasury to get revenue. It would be fairer. Britain is unusual in having no form of taxation on your property. And these are a set of assets which have appreciated by, as I say, in the whole, trillions and trillions of pounds. And older homeowners have seen those huge untaxed gains since the 1980s. Younger generations, priced out of ownership, often pay high rents, massive rents, to those same people with no equivalent asset growth. So maybe it is time, I'm just saying, to redress that balance. Why am I wrong? 0345 6060973. Text is always 84850. Let's get the latest news, shall we? 11:30 with Amelia Cox.
LBC understands the head of Britain's armed forces is travelling to the US to discuss America's involvement in security guarantees for Ukraine. Donald Trump says they will be involved in efforts to ward off future Russian aggression in the event of a peace deal. Mediators from Qatar and Egypt are waiting for a formal response from Israel about plans for a 60-day ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas has reportedly accepted the plan by the US in exchange for the partial release of some Israeli hostages. And the Home Office is yet to confirm claims the UK has dropped its demand to be able to access the encrypted data of Apple users worldwide. The US Director of National Intelligence made the announcement on social media. LBC weather, widespread cloud across much of the UK, Wales, southeast England and far western Scotland will see the best of the sunshine, heavy showers for southwest England, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Tesco finest sugar bell tomatoes, the ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe, to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddie.
Book a free hearing test today at bootshearingcare.com and save up to £300 with our free technology upgrade. Boots, with you for life. T's and C's apply. See website for details.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. Two sugars in mind? Tough. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you? Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time now is 12:33. I'm joined in the studio now by a very obscure figure, a man called, I don't know, he hosts this show called The News Agents USA, which I don't think many people listen to, really. John Sopel is in the studio with me. This is a little amuse-bouche for us, John, before we go and record The News Agents in about half an hour's time. I'm going to talk a little bit about what happened yesterday. John, something you and I have talked about repeatedly in the many episodes of The News Agents that we've done over the past 36 hours is about the role Trump has played in all this. And in the episode we did last night, we talked a little bit about how he may have changed. Do you think he's changed in this term with regards to international affairs?
I think he's much more engaged. I mean, it tends to happen, doesn't it, that the first term of a prime minister is very focused on domestic affairs, and then you get slightly bored by domestic affairs, and then you look to the world to burnish your credentials. Mm. And you almost get a feeling that Donald Trump, for all the isolationism, for all the America first, for all the pulling up the drawbridge, Donald Trump wants to be seen as this pivotal figure on the world stage. And he loves theatre. Mm. And yesterday he combined the two. Yesterday, he combined the two by bringing together, you know, more leaders into the White House at any one time than has ever been seen before. And you can see that he absolutely relished it. And he was the circus master, and everyone was paying homage to him, because the European leaders have figured out if you go in and try and bash Donald Trump over the head, you're not going to get anywhere. But if you're flattering and obsequious and deferential and grovelling...
That's what I've learned with you over the years.
Yeah, I wish. And crawling, then you might get somewhere. And look, I think the European leaders are professing satisfaction with what happened, but it's what happens next that matters rather than the optics and the theatre of what unfolded yesterday.
Do you think that, I mean, he's now sort of 24 hours on. It seems, I mean, Starmer is chairing this coalition of the willing. And yet we're still unclear really what that means. And we're unclear, I mean, this security guarantee stuff that Trump talked about yesterday, it felt to me as if the Europeans had heard him say it, they grabbed it because they were so desperate for it for so long. And yet the truth is, it's so nebulous as to what it might mean.
Weather forecasters talk about wispy clouds, and it all feels a little bit wispy, what we've got at the moment. What is the security guarantee? It's going to be Article 5, like the NATO treaty, you know, which is that an attack on one is an attack on all. Okay, but what are the kind of mechanisms by where you invoke that? Who's going to control it? What is America's role in it? Is it really sending troops? No, probably not. Is it coordination role? What does that mean, a coordination role? I think there's still a huge amount that has to happen. And the other thing that they talked about yesterday was this bilateral meeting between Putin and Zelensky, and a possible trilateral meeting between Trump, Putin and Zelensky. And I just get the impression from the Kremlin that they're going to be putting as much sand as they can in the gears, setting conditions that are impossible to meet. And I have, you know, maybe I'm wrong. I doubt it's going to happen.
You're very rarely wrong. What do you think's motivating him? Because, I mean, I'm fascinated by this now. Because, I mean, I was so, you know, I was so struck yesterday, and we talked about this yesterday, but he, in that first exchange with Zelensky, when you compare it to how he was in February, I mean, obviously, there was none of the, it wasn't nearly as brusque and as hostile. But also, so rarely for Trump, he was, all of the journalists, particularly some of the propagandists that he had there, they kept lobbing in the ball. And he refused to try and catch the ball, right? He would not take the bait the whole time. All these things that normally he would respond to. He was, in Trump terms, in the main, quite diplomatic, careful with his words. He wants this, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, I think he does. Look, there is the desire on Donald Trump's part to bring peace. I mean, just simply he wants to see the killing stopped. And God bless him for that. You know, who could argue? Who wants the killing to continue? And it was very striking. He knew the traps that were being laid for him. You know, what would give an easy soundbite? What would make a headline?
There was that
Donald
bit when
Trump
someone
was avoiding giving headlines.
There was that bit when someone said, "Which side do you think has the cards?"
Yeah,
which I thought was most telling. Which and of course that was one of those bits when he did blow up with Zelensky in February when he just was screaming at him. You know, you don't have the cards. With us, you've got cards. You don't have cards. And he just said, I don't want to talk about who's got cards. And what a change compared to February.
Yeah, and also, you know, the statement that Donald Trump had previously made that it was Ukraine that had started the war with Russia in 2022, and he was asked that, and he kind of didn't repeat that, which would have obviously been incendiary. It's like Donald Trump knows I've got to play this carefully and delicately to get to where I want this to go. Now, whether it's going to be in Russia's favour or Ukraine's favour remains to be seen. My instinct is that he still leans towards Putin. He's irresistibly drawn towards him, that any deal will be favouring Putin. But let us see on that. But I think that what we saw yesterday was a Donald Trump who knew what the pitfalls were and didn't want to kind of do anything that would make the day more difficult than it needed be.
On another matter, anyone who's watching yesterday, let me explain to people, because I've actually seen a few people asking for us to talk about it. This question of Trump, who was controlled in that meeting, apart from on a few issues which just trigger him and which he can't help but go off on one about. And one of those, of course, is this question of mail-in voting, where he claimed that,
you know, America is the only country in the world left that has mail-in voting.
Yeah, oh, apart from the 31 others.
Yeah, and I think we had mail-in voting last year at the general election. I can't remember any claims of fraud.
And he sort of, you know, Zelensky's having to sit there as he goes off in a long monologue about how appalling mail-in voting is and how they need to abolish it and Democrat states were. Why does he hate it so much?
Because he thinks it's what cost him the 2020 election. He thinks that it was mail-in ballots alone that did it. That, you know, it looked like I was winning in Pennsylvania, and then suddenly they bring in all these mail-in ballots, and suddenly I'm losing. There is no basis for it. It has been investigated. There have been court cases that were brought trying to challenge the basis of this, and it's all been found wanting. He also wants to ban voting machines, which, again, I mean, you know, the slur that the voting machines used were unfair cost Fox News $787 million when they repeated the allegation that Dominion voting machines were switching votes for Trump to Joe Biden. So there is no evidence of any of this. It is an obsession with Donald Trump, just as windmills are killing all the birds, just as water pressure isn't what it used to be, just as, you know, so many other things where Donald Trump has a pet concern, and you can tell him he's wrong, and you can say the facts don't bear this out, but that doesn't get you anywhere.
Well, if people like these sorts of musings, you know what they can do, can't they?
They could listen to a podcast. What's it called?
I've got no idea. You can listen to The News Agents, of course, every single day, or indeed over the last 48 hours, every single hour, it feels like. John Soper, my co-host of The News Agents, there. Let's talk now to Lucy, who's in Muswell Hill, who's got something to say, I think, about stamp duty. Lucy.
Good afternoon, Lewis. Thank you for taking my call.
Not at all.
I agree with the previous caller that you had from Newcastle. I couldn't agree with him more. insofar as I think that it would be a ludicrous idea for the tax as you have proposed, or as Rachel Reeves is thinking about, or in agreement with. I don't feel that if you're selling a property that you would pay stamp duty, because I think that it would just stagnate the sales. People wouldn't sell their property.
But on that basis, you'd say no one would buy one, because stamp duty is currently being applied to purchase.
Yes, but I think it's fine as it is purchased, because you know you have the anticipation of knowing exactly what you're paying. If you're paying...
But that would be the case if you just change the system.
Yes, but if you were then selling your property and you're going to buy another property, people would never be able to buy an equivalent value property, because they've then got to allow for X in the tax.
Hang on a minute. Like, if you sell your property... Many people sell their property at a considerable profit. You've already got much of that asset. So I don't understand why, when you're buying a property, you've had no profit. You've just got to scrape and scrimp the money together to get that money together.
But everyone has to do that.
Well, yeah,
except
that there'll be lots of people who can't do that because they're young and they don't have the money.
But we've all had to do it in the past.
You're not arguing from self-interest, are you, by any chance?
No, if you were selling your property at, say, 700,000, for argument's sake, and then you were expected to pay stamp duty on the sale of that, you wouldn't be buying another property for 700,000 in a different area, because you've then got to pay the stamp duty.
Of course you would. It depends what the percentage is. It depends how much is charged. The whole point many people make significant profit because on the basis of house prices, right? So to ask people to pay stamp duty on the basis of purchase, right, when they have made no profit, it's very difficult to see how that's equitable or fair. You're saying, oh, well, we all had to do that. My point to you is that there are many people who are not privileged enough to even be able to do that, because stamp duty presents a huge disincentive to the purchase in the first place. And very few other countries in the world do it that way.
It's just an additional tax. With regards to your...
Right. Well, so would be on your sale. So would be on your sale.
But you would know how much it is in anticipation. But I think in view of your council tax argument, I think that I don't have a problem with the council tax. I think it's far too much in my area. But I think that there need to be more bans for it.
Right.
Because I think that once you get to, you know, sort of, I think a property in Band G is the equivalent of something that could be worth about, you know, 1.2 million, and it could be the same if you're 45 million.
Okay. Well, I agree with that, Lucy. I think, right, the council tax system is absolutely ridiculous. Lucy in Muswell Hill there. The problem with this is always... I mean, with respect to anybody, I mean, it's weird, isn't it, how people who would not benefit from this tax, or at least who might fear they might pay more, are always against it. I mean, without thinking about actually the current system is a huge problem for people who have not been as fortunate as them, just in terms of when they were born. The fact of the matter is, we have seen the most enormous property appreciation. I'm sorry. I know this is hard for some people to hear, but if you're sat in a house, say you paid £100,000 for it, and just because we haven't built enough houses, and just because that place has become more desirable, and suddenly you sell it for £1 million, I'm sorry, you haven't done anything to make that happen. You've just sat there and watched it appreciate in value. Yeah, you may have done some improvements in the house, and that's completely fair enough. Okay, fair enough. But at the end of the day, what we've seen is a massive windfall for a series of generations who just happen to be born at the right time and happen to be able to buy at the right time. And what is frustrating is that there is not enough cognizance of that and thinking about how we can perhaps use some of that resources, use some of that wealth to make sure that younger generations are afforded the same privilege. I do not understand why that is controversial, and yet I know it is. 0345 60 60 973.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Amid the noise and drama of the White House press conference, President Trump suggested he'd support a European security guarantee for Ukraine. But how exactly?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
People ask me, what's my good place? Down the park, having fun with Toby, my cockapoo. And knowing that my pension with PensionBee is managed by experienced money managers. So, not chasing the stick then, Toby? No?
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionbee.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
Huh. Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walker's. Delicious.
Buying a home on a holiday park was a dream that became a nightmare. High-pressure sales tactics, huge site fee increases, and a loss of value have left many customers feeling misled, angry, and trapped. But the Holiday Park Advice Centre can help. Contact us today and we'll help claim back any money you're owed on your holiday home. Text ASSIST to 78900 to get started.
Hello, Holiday Park Advice Centre.
That's ASSIST to 78900.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby and Well Kid. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:48. We're talking about stamp duty and proposed changes, although we should say nothing's been confirmed by the Treasury. It's been reported by The Guardian, though the sourcing does seem very good, that the Treasury is thinking about abolishing stamp duty and having a shake-up to property taxation in this country. Rob in Brixton has got something to say about this, I think. Rob, good afternoon.
Hello, Lewis. How are you doing? Have you read The Hobbit?
Many years ago. I didn't expect that would be your opening gambit, I have to say, Rob, but fair enough. I'm enjoying it. Let's go down the rabbit hole.
So, especially listening to your, to your callers, if Smaug the Dragon was a person, there'd be a boomer with a house.
Again, I did not expect to go there. I think more like Sauron, to be honest, but never mind.
Yeah, they're just, hoarding these little gold coins. Right, listen, so I've got to put some context into my point, because I personally would be happy to pay a percentage on sale of my house. I own a flat in, obviously, Brixton. I inherited that flat. I'm 37 years old.
Right.
I'm going to be open about numbers. The flat is worth £450,000.
Yep.
So I've got this flat, and I don't want to live in it for whatever reasons. Mostly emotional. I don't want to be tied to the house anymore. So I'm moving.
Right.
Why don't I move to somewhere else? Bristol, Brighton, be closer to family. So I'm thinking, yeah, this easy peasy, right?
Yeah.
Not so easy. Stamp duty comes in.
Yeah.
Turns out, anywhere you want to live that's, half decent, and, I get downsizing. I want to downsize, but you don't want to live somewhere uncomfortable if you're already kind of comfortable. So that's a natural human instinct. So I'm looking at somewhere half decent, half nice. Everywhere, same properties are the same price. You look at Manchester, you look at Brighton. It's not just London. So I'm thinking, right, I'm going to have to do a 1-to-1 swap.
Okay.
Might make a little bit of profit if I get something if I negotiate shrewdly. No, stamp duty, absolutely, I'm stuck here. So the example that was given before about, an older person being stuck in the house, it's not just them. There's a whole generation, my generation of people, that are about to inherit all these houses.
This is exactly
from their boomer parents.
But this is the point, right, is that the problem with stamp duty, the current system basically incentivizes and gives benefit to those with existing wealth, and it basically penalizes those who are on income, who have got to try and sort of scrape together some of that liquid income in order to pay stamp duty. And it's just crazy.
Exactly. I want this flat to go to somebody who will enjoy it more than I will, or who needs it more than I will.
But couldn't you just use? Couldn't you just use the proceeds of the sale to pay for stamp duty?
I absolutely could. But then I'm enforced. I'm looking at right. So I move into a fixer upper where I've got to spend
not enough money there.
An extra 20-30 grand, which I don't have.
Yeah,
okay. You know. So I'm it's because of the way the property market is. I should be able to just be like, here's nearly £500,000. I can buy a house anywhere I want. No,
yeah,
no.
Well, you'd think so.
Not at all. But if I did make a profit of say 50, 60, even 100 grand. And there was a tax of 2-3% on that. Well, of course, absolutely fine, because I haven't earned that money. Yeah. I'm happy for it to go into social housing or whatever. And this is where the massive disconnect is because I've benefited from the state. I think I was on the dole for a year when I was 18. I've used public services. My bin's been collected. I'm happy to pay in. And then you've got these boomers that are literally calling you up to argue that no, don't take any more of my coins. I've paid tax on this. We've all paid 20% tax on goods and services. What are you talking about?
Well, I know that annoys me as well. That winds me up saying it's been taxed already. All income's been taxed already. Every time I'm like, honestly, what? Why should it just be exempted? I mean, Rob, I'm grateful to you. Thank you very much. I've got a text here from Nikki from Kent. Said, God save me from the moaning millenniums, shouldn't be millennials, and grumbling generation X and Z, and all of the rest of them. That's a Coldplay album, isn't it? Yes, I'm a hated baby boomer, but don't worry, we'll all be dead soon. And because of the hatred shown towards us, I'm going to spend every penny I've got. Oh, you're not going off on one, are you, Nikki? I've got left. I'm going to have lost two houses in the recessions. Anybody would think we had it all wonderful, all our lives. Just leave us alone. As I said, we're all dead soon. Tom, you won't read this out, will you? Well, Tom won't, but Lewis did. That's one for you, Nikki. Phil is in Blackburn. Phil?
Hiya.
Hello, Phil. Afternoon. What have you got to say about this?
Well, I'm actually a boomer. I'm selling my house at the moment, and the stamp duty has become such an issue, I'm paying it.
Oh, really? Could be what, because it's become such a problem in terms of younger, new buyers paying it?
Well, ironically, my buyer is another boomer who's downsizing, but making such a song and dance about it. I thought, well, the fastest way to get this done, because I'm moving for the very best of reasons.
Right.
I'm getting married, so I want this show to go through. Thank you. I just basically said to the buyer, right, look, if it's a sticking point, I'll pay the stamp duty.
And how much are we talking?
Well, it's a £320,000 house, so the stamp duty on that is, what, about 12 grand,
isn't that crazy for, like, you know, 320 grand house, that's a bit above the national average, but not much, you know, modest in terms of the average overall, and paying 12 grand of liquid capital just to find for a buyer to pay for it on a house that is not much more than that national average, it's a lot.
It is a lot, and I think that the alternative methods of taxing property are a better way forward.
Yeah,
I've just come back from Canada, where they have a annual property tax, which is based on a percentage of the value of the property. It's about 1%.
Yeah.
And everyone pays that. They then don't have the other taxes that go along with it. And that seems to make a lot more sense than the current way we tax properties. But I'm lucky. I'm mortgage free, so I can afford to do it. But I can understand, and most boomers are.
Yeah.
So,
well, indeed.
And I've always wondered why we have taxed the buyers rather than the sellers.
It does
make more sense.
I agree. It's absolutely crazy. Phil in Blackburn, as I say, that is why we would tax the buyers on purchase. It's just crazy, as opposed to the people who will have actually made money from the appreciation. It's just crazy. And the only reason we think, like, that it's normal is just because that's the system we've got and people haven't been used to it. I get it. But I think if we were starting from here, surely we would not start from here. Elliot is in Weybridge. Elliot.
Hi, Lewis. How are you today?
I'm not bad, thank you. Nearly at 1 o'clock, so about to take a breather before going and record the news agents. No. Go on, please.
Okay. So, look, I'm in a very fortunate position. My wife and I bought our house 20 years ago.
Right.
For like £180,000. And 20 years later, we've paid our mortgage off in our mid-50s. And it's the house is worth £500,000 now. So I've made around £320,000. 16 grand a year, there or thereabouts, for doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and yes, there are properties that have, if I want to try and move locally,
then there's no way I could possibly afford it. I'm not going to take out another £500,000 mortgage to, at my time of year, age, to get something else. But, you know, it's just peculiar. There's a lottery as to where you live and just happened to be how much money that cost. You know, my sister-in-law did exactly the same thing, but she bought a place in Newcastle. And her house is appreciated by £70,000 in exactly the same amount of time. And so I just feel as though I'm just very fortunate. And I feel as though I'm able, you know, if there was to be an extra tax, then I'd be happy to pay that. Because I, you know, I have, for no cleverness of my own or no hard work of my own,
okay,
I've managed to accrue, you know, loads of money.
All right, Elliot, grateful to you. Let's give the last word now to Nora, who's on the Wirral. Nora.
Hi, Lewis. I agree with you about the stamp duty. It does make more sense to put it on the under the seller than the purchaser. But I think in reality, that would just mean they just incorporate it into the price of the house. I mean, they just put the house price up. So it would go onto a mortgage instead of having to find it up front. So, you know, the purchaser would still pay it, but just in a roundabout way. But the other thing is the council tax. What I would love to see is an incorporate the energy bands with the council tax bands. So that if you improve the energy rating on your house, you got a less council tax. You went that upper band on the council tax.
Yeah, well, I mean, the council tax is, I mean, the problem is, I mean, it is, again, another bit of the nuttiness of British politics that, you know, we are still doing local property taxation in this country on the basis of what property taxation was like or property values were like in the early 1990s. Never mind pre-iPhone, it's basically pre-internet. I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely mad. Does the current system put you off moving, Nora?
Well, the current system doesn't, but the thought of the tax every year would, because that would just be, I mean, I would accept it because I can see the equity of it, but yeah. I just think for me, because I'm in a position, I've got an expensive house and a moderate income, so, you know, it would just cost me more money than I could afford, so I'd probably have to sell, but, you know, if that's the case, that's the case.
All right, Nora, on the world, you had the last word. Well, actually, not quite the last word. Last word to Richard, who's texting a very pithy analysis of today's show. He said, Lewis, are you brainless? Don't know. We'll find out tomorrow, I suppose. We'll give it another roll of the dice. That is it for me for another day. I'll be back tomorrow morning from 10. If you missed any of today's show, of course, you can listen back on Catch Up on both Global Player, the brand new LBC app. You can stay up to date there with all the latest news, opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause, rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts, including The News Agents, which I'm off to record with John Soper right now. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ben Kentish. But now it's time for the never brainless, deeply cerebral Sheila Fogarty.
Deeply. I was called a moron yesterday, so you got off lightly.
Really?
Yeah. By a listener.
Right, we'll find. We'll go and
we'll find them.
We'll go look through his bins later.
We'll brain him. Thanks very much, Lewis. At three today, a third of parents are using buy now, pay later schemes to afford school uniforms. Half are relying on credit cards. This is insanity. A quarter are going without heating or food to cover the cost. When are we going to wake up about school uniforms? At two, just how safe is the Online Safety Act going to make our children? But straight up after the news, those events in Washington yesterday, the wide smiles, the encouraging words from Donald Trump at yesterday's peace summit at the White House, certainly gave us a sense of momentum building over Russia, Ukraine and a deal. But is it any more than that? A sense. We'll also talk about Melania's letter to Vladimir Putin.
On your radio, on the LBC app and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, LBC understands Britain's chief of the defence staff is travelling to the US for talks on America's involvement in Ukraine security guarantees. Sir Tony Radkin will flesh out the details after Donald Trump says they would be involved in efforts to ward off future Russian aggression. The head of the army has been talking about the risks posed by the situation in Ukraine at an arms conference in Edinburgh this lunchtime. General Sir Roy Walker says European countries have to respond to a change in the relationship with Russia.
The assumptions that underpin the post-Cold War era no longer hold. And as the war in Ukraine makes clear, Russia no longer seeks mutual coexistence with us here on the European continent. Rather, their new norm is confrontation. And that has triggered a fundamental shift in policy and security posture across the Euro-Atlantic area.
Israel is due to give a formal response to proposals for a 60-day ceasefire in Gaza, which has been accepted by Hamas. It would see the group release some Israeli hostages in return. Israel has previously said it wants a comprehensive deal, which includes freeing all remaining captives. The High Court is due to rule in the next hour whether a hotel in Essex can continue housing asylum seekers. There have been protests outside the Bell in Epping, which has prompted the District Council to seek an injunction. Lawyers for the hotel argue it would set a dangerous precedent. It's understood the Chancellor Rachel Reeves is considering a major reform of stamp duty in England and Northern Ireland. Instead, people who own and live in properties worth more than £500,000 could pay an annual tax. The government says it won't comment on speculation. But Freddie Poser, who runs campaign group Priced Out, says he'd welcome a change.
If you can get this right, there are all sorts of positive effects that beyond affordability that a property tax can make. It's a direct property tax replacement for stamp duty that raises the same amount of revenue, won't necessarily make homes more affordable. The real advantage here is about encouraging better use of the existing properties we have and making it easier for people to move homes, to move around the country for jobs, that sort of thing.
And Sir Gareth Southgate is being honoured with a special prize later for his services to football. He's joined by record-breaking former Chelsea women's boss Emma Hayes. They're both getting the Professional Footballers Association's Merit Award. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 31 points at 91.89. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, widespread cloud across much of the UK. Wales, southeast England and far western Scotland will see the best of the sunshine. Heavy showers for southwest England, highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there. Good afternoon to you. A little later in the programme, after two, we're going to return to questions of online safety and your children, our children's safety. This is after the father of Molly Russell, who took her own life as a result of online material, has warned that there is still far too much out there easily accessible for kids online, and that the internet companies aren't doing enough about it, and that the new online safety bill isn't strong enough to deal with it. We'll talk about that after two. But I want to reflect this first hour on what happened yesterday in the White House. There's an awful lot to think about, isn't there, when it comes to the war in Ukraine. There's the sort of drama and theatre of what we saw yesterday in the White House, particularly the moment when Donald Trump and Vladimir Zelensky sat next to one another and took questions in the Oval Office. But there's also the whole question of European leaders and what they achieved or not in the process of that emergency peace summit that was held yesterday. We can talk through things that we did learn from it in a moment, but it's probably worth, for the sake of many of you, I'm sure, who didn't watch it all yesterday evening or listen to it all here on LBC yesterday evening, just a reminder of what went on. Donald Trump yesterday evening confirmed arrangements are underway for the Ukrainian and Russian presidents to meet, as well as making some kind of EU-US security guarantees.
There'll be a lot of help. When it comes to security, there's going to be a lot of help. It's going to be good. They are first line of defense because they're there. They're Europe. But we're going to help them out also. We'll be involved.
Well, it's not clear how, but that's an interesting one to talk about this afternoon. One particular moment that stood out back in February when the American and Ukrainian leaders met was the criticism of Zelensky for not wearing a suit. You'll remember that. One of the journalists asked him about it. Yesterday, that very same journalist made a comment on what Zelensky was wearing yesterday.
President Zelensky, you look fabulous in that suit.
I said the same thing.
Yeah, you look good.
I said the same thing.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? That's the one that attacked you last time. See, now he's...
I remember that.
I know. No, my first question for you, President Zelensky...
But you are in the same suit. You see, I changed your...
Maybe yours is much better.
Well, I think to have pulled off a proper joke and a good laugh in the middle of all of that is a sign of a cool character, to say the least. This is what Sir Keir Starmer said later on around the table of the European leaders and Donald Trump.
I think this is such an important meeting. As a group, I think we've had a discussion on the phone a number of times, Mr. President, but be able now to be around the table to take it forward. And I really feel that we can, I think, with the right approach this afternoon, make real progress, particularly on the security guarantees, and your indication of security guarantees, of some sort of Article 5 style guarantees, fits with what we've been doing with the Coalition of the Willing, which we started some months ago, bringing countries together and showing that we were prepared to step up to the plate when it came to security, with you coming alongside the US, alongside what we've already developed. I think we could take a really important step forward today. A historic step, actually, could come out of this meeting in terms of security for Ukraine and security in Europe.
So you got the impression at the end of it all that the EU leaders and the UK, obviously we're not in the EU, but that the European leaders had very much prepped jointly for this, hadn't they? They knew what they wanted from it. They knew that what they were going to put into it. You got the sense there'd been a great deal of, it's a bit patronising to say coaching of Zelensky, but wrapping around Zelensky to make sure that things didn't go awry like they did back in February. There was also another nice moment when Vladimir Zelensky handed President Trump a letter from Mrs. Zelensky, his wife, but it was for the First Lady. It wasn't for Donald Trump. And that's because the First Lady, Melania Trump, had, we learned, written to Vladimir Putin directly herself, appealing for the 20,000 missing Ukrainian children. Well, not missing. Well, they are missing, but they've been abducted deliberately by Russian forces into Russian-held territory, or Russian, or Russia proper. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, had this to say about that.
Mentioned the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been abducted. And as a mother and grandmother, every single child has to go back to its family. This should be one of our main priorities also in these negotiations, to make sure that the